Rick Smith is next. Have a great weekend. The irony is disgusting. And now the radiation is probably heading or has headed toward West Virginia. Combine it with mountaintop removal, and the good folks in West Virginia are being hit twice, once from GE and once from the coal industry. I never thought your small town would be a victim of capitalism and no one cares. Boy, was I wrong, says Tim. Thanks for the note, Tim. And thanks for the reminder. Regardless of how one faces the history of the means by which we ended the war in the Pacific, it must be remembered. There will be, well, it's tomorrow. It's tomorrow in Hiroshima already, isn't it? And there will be a tolling of a bell at some point. A quiet reminder of the horrors of nuclear war. And we must remember that we, the United States, the good guys, are the only country ever to nuke another country. And the debate is still open as to whether it was necessary. The Japanese had begun suing for peace a couple of months earlier. They had asked for surrender terms. Their primary term was that they be allowed to keep their emperor. And we said no thanks. Unconditional surrender or no surrender at all. And so after the atomic attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that unconditional surrender was tendered, and we let them keep their emperor anyway. And what does that tell?
Well, they're going to open a window where folks can go and apply for the licensing. We're going to talk a little bit about how you do that. Maybe we get some more community radio stations. Maybe we begin to take back, just on a very small level, start to take back the airwaves and begin to have local programming again. I think that's a great thing, and we'll talk to Jeff about that. And then also in the second hour, Erica Smiley with Jobs with Justice going to be here talking about their conference that we're going to be heading to this weekend. So tomorrow we're going to be out of the studio. We're going to do a best of, and on Friday we're going to be at the Jobs with Justice conference, covering that and doing what we do there. Also, we'll be running a recorded program on Friday. So today, I think most people are kind of taken back a little bit, taking a break, getting kind of cleansing themselves of the debt talk, if you will. I think everyone's had about enough debt talk for a while. And now's the time to start talking about, well, what next? What's coming down the road? And Bruce Bartlett, who's been getting a lot of play here lately. He was a former senior policy advisor under Reagan and, of course, under George H.W. Bush. He published an article doing away with the debt ceiling over at the New York Times, I believe it was. And now he's saying, look, at the end of the day, what's going to happen from this day forward is that it doesn't matter who the minority is. It could be the Republicans, could be the Democrats. They are going to hold the country hostage. Because they're going to be able to hold on to their demands. They're going to be able to basically hold hostage the minority or the majority by not allowing this to continue and taking us to the brink. And he predicts at some point down the road, be it a Democratic president or a Republican president, it doesn't matter. One party or the other is going to take this to the line. And then there's no going back. And over you go. So this debt limit hostage situation, he's advocating doing away with the debt ceiling. In fact, he's been talking about doing that for several years. And, you know, I asked the question, do we do away with the debt ceiling? Personally, I think it's dumb. Where we should be focusing our attention, we should be focusing on each particular bill that Congress passes and then appropriating funds for it as you pass it. I've been making the argument through this whole thing that every bill that's out there, everything that's out there should have been appropriated for. There should have been money set aside for it, earmarked, if you will, to pay for it. So this debt ceiling, as soon as you passed the bill last year or 6 months ago or whenever you did it, and you knew it was going to take us over the ceiling, you broke the debt ceiling, and it's no longer any good. So I think it's time to get rid of it, personally. And you look at what Mitch McConnell said, the Republican from Kentucky, fully admitting that the Republicans took the debt ceiling hostage and claimed that it was worth ransoming. In fact, the exact quote by the Senate Minority Leader in the Washington Post today was, quote, "I think some of our members may have thought the default issue was a hostage. You might take a chance at shooting." Most of us didn't think that way. What we did learn is this. It's a hostage situation that's worth ransoming. And it focuses the Congress on doing something that must be done. He also goes on saying, you know what? Can imagine doing it again. And actually, he's promised to do it again in the past. So you're looking at this and you're going, maybe it's time to solve this problem once and for all. Personally, you know, with this whole super duper committee that they want to form, I wish and I hope that they will look at it in a balanced way and say, look, you know, we can't do it all with spending cuts. We have to raise revenue. And if you look at the fact of the matter, we are taxing at the lowest rate since at least the 1940s, 1950s. It's the lowest rate since the end of World War II. And the wealthy, well, they're doing wildly well. So to ask them for a little bit more, I don't think is all that out of line. So welcome to day six. Here we are, the other hostage situation. One crisis averted, another one begun by the radical right. This is day six of the latest Republican-led hostage crisis. They have thrown government workers out of the FAA funding authorization bill, not passed. There's some talk of maybe, who knows. I'm not seeing it. They're on vacation for 5 weeks. But they're holding us hostage again. And the more I look at this, the more I say, you know, how much do Republicans hate working people that they would throw these 4,000 FAA workers out onto the street? And this anywhere between, and I've seen numbers between 90 and 200,000 private sector workers who are also in the street because all of the programs, all of the building projects that were going to be done and were in the process of being done have now stopped because there's no money for it. And if you remember the whole talk over the last hostage situation over the debt, it was because it was our debt, right? You look at this scenario. We're not taking in $30 million a day. $30 million a day, the Treasury is light. Not to mention somewhere between 94,000 and 204,000 workers who are not earning an income and paying taxes to the government. Not only that, they're collecting unemployment benefits, which is taxing us that much more. And, you know, I listened to Eric Cantor talk about that very specific thing here. And I'm amazed at what he said. And you got to hear this because it's just remarkable that even he knows what's the truth. And I've been saying this about tax cuts. I've been saying this about deregulation. I've been saying this about the whole right-wing agenda. He's asked this question. Listen to this.
Do you then think is it legal for airlines to still be collecting these FAA fees, taxes, whatever we call them?
Well, you know, it's not a question of legality. It's a question of the fact that the authority, FAA, is not functioning right now, so they cannot levy the tax. And what airlines have done is have stepped in and said, well, if we're not going to pay that money to the federal government, we're going to keep it towards our own bottom line. And I guess that's what business does.
They're going to keep it toward their own bottom line. He says, you know, hey, the FAA is not functional, not working. Well, why isn't it working? Oh, that's right. You haven't passed the reauthorization bill. You and the majority. You guys haven't been able to do that. And you look at this and you go, this $30 million a day, $200 million a week of taxes that people flying are not paying to the government, they're still paying to someone. And Cantor fully admits, hey, that's what business does. They're pocketing it. They're putting it in their bottom line. That's what business does. So I keep telling you, at the end of the day, you give all these tax cuts to business, you give all these tax cuts to the rich, it's not going to bring anything down. You deregulate, it's not going to bring the price down. It's going to fatten the bottom line, which is exactly what they've been doing to us for the last, 40 years. And I look at this latest hostage situation, you got to go, folks, when are they going to release the FAA? But then again, you stop and think about it. Today is the 30th anniversary of Ronald Reagan issuing the threat. Day after tomorrow, 30 years ago, he will have fired the Patco workers. And understand why the Patco workers did what they did. It wasn't about money. And Reagan, in his speeches at the time, said, well, we've given them so much money. It's not, we've given them the biggest bonuses. They're making more than everybody else. And, trying to make people go, well, gee, they're making money. Why aren't they happy? It was about safety. It was about the safety of the passengers. It was about the safety of the planes. It was about the fact that we were using antiquated equipment and that these people were being burnt out. That's what it was about. But what they pushed at us, these greedy people. And when the government came down, they came down hard on the workers. 19 separate courts moved to force the workers back to work. They brought criminal charges against the union leadership and even members. It was reported by ABC that the FBI was even compiling data against those workers. They're going to find out about you, mister. The $3.5 million strike fund that Patco had, they seized, and they pushed for a decertification vote so they could push the union out. They could put them out of business. And you look, here we are 30 years later, after the shot heard crossed the boardroom, when Reagan came out and day after tomorrow fired 13,000 air traffic controllers, and in an unprecedented fashion, banned them from employment forever. Forever. And you go back and you look at all of the situations that have happened in the past. And you could go back and say that there were 39 of these type work stoppages against the federal government from about 62 to 1981, to when Reagan did this. There were 39 of them. And nobody fired anyone. They worked and got people back to work. Reagan used this as that here, my campaign donors, here, the people I hold allegiance to, this is what I'm doing for you. It's the shot heard across the boardroom, and from that point forward, it has been attack working people every day since. And you look at the fact that you can lay the numbers down on the table, you can lay the graphs out, it is that moment that the middle class completely stagnates and begins to really decline. And that's when the middle class in this country becomes squeezed and squeezed. And then you see more of these corporate marauders buying, merging, and stealing pension funds. That was the Reagan years. Greed was good. Corporatism was good. The benevolent corporation. I think back to my grandfather. He knew corporation was no good. They were decent people to work for. But at the end of the day, if it came down to the boss's kid eating or his kid eating, he knew which kid was going to eat. And for me, that's what this is about. So when we come back, we're going to talk with our good friend Irwin Aronson about the Patco strike, the whole scenario, also the unemployment compensation situation that's going to be coming up here in the state. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. If you want to weigh in, we're right back after this. Beat up cars.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. In Michigan, public opinion is running against Republican Governor Snyder for his slash-and-burn budget and deep cuts to education. The Michigan Education Association says while Snyder succeeded in pushing the cuts through, his victory may be short-lived. Doug Cunningham reports.
The Michigan Senate has approved Republican Governor Rick Snyder's slashing of public education funding, more than $1 billion in cuts affecting all levels of Michigan public education. The cuts, though, are highly unpopular with the people of Michigan, according to polls. Michigan Education Association spokesman Doug Pratt says the Republican action is not the last word on public education funding in Michigan.
It's not really a done deal until the voters have a chance to react, and they're going to react. Polling shows that the public is incensed about this, and they're going to make their voices heard in November of 2012, if not sooner. The governor's approval rating has gone through the floor. The governor has said repeatedly that that's not something he's worried about. The lawmakers who have to run for re-election in November of 2012 are going to start to care very much.
Unemployment insurance programs are under attack. So far in the first half of 2011, 10 states have placed new restrictions or deep cuts on how unemployment is collected. The National Employment Law Project released a study this week finding 6 states had slashed the maximum number of weeks unemployment insurance can be claimed to less than 26. That number of weeks has been the standard in every state of the union for more than 50 years. Michigan, one of the states hardest hit by the employment crisis, cut the available weeks to 20. Missouri and South Carolina did the same. Florida has placed their unemployment benefits on a sliding scale. The higher the unemployment rate in the state, the more weeks available. If the unemployment rate in Florida slips down to 5%, only 12 weeks of unemployment can be claimed. Indiana has changed the way it calculates benefits. The average unemployment benefits will drop by $63 starting in July of 2012. Only 2 states, Colorado and Rhode Island, have addressed the unemployment insurance solvency issue by raising and indexing the taxable wage base. Many states instead chose to offer tax breaks to employers. The project is calling on the federal government to intervene. In their study, they proposed 3 possible relief solutions. One of the solutions is a proposal by Senator Dick Durbin and offers to waive federal interest payments on trust fund borrowing for 2 years, delay federal unemployment tax increases, and forgives up to 60% of state loans if states agree not to cut programs.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News.
It is for this reason that I must tell those who fail to report for duty this morning, they are in violation of the law, and if they do not report for work within 48 hours, they have forfeited their jobs and will be terminated.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. You know, that's one of the songs talking about that era. You know, the song was written 4 years ago, but you know, here we are, the 30th anniversary of that moment. And again, you know, for too long, folks think, well, it was about money. It wasn't. It was about safety. It was about using antiquated equipment. It was about the travel that we all do. But again, you know, it's all in the messaging. That's why I've asked our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson, to come talk to us about the 30th anniversary of the Patco firings. Irwin, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, good to be here, Rick.
You know, I look at this, 30 years ago today, President Reagan made that threat. Day after tomorrow, he does fire 15,000 folks. You look at this and you look back with an eye and you say maybe that was a time we should have reacted a little viscerally.
Well, it's a sad anniversary, and it's an important date in the history of the American labor movement. It is the 30th anniversary of the day Ronald Reagan made it safe and appropriate and emboldened the private sector piece of the world to treat the right of workers to organize and bargain collectively with a categorical difference from all that had happened before. It's intriguing that today we have cretins like Governor Scott Walker in Wisconsin who rely on cite to and quote, actually misquote, Ronald Reagan for various and sundry concepts and principles. But intriguingly enough, Reagan did not believe that workers should be denied the right to organize and bargain collectively. He, in fact, used to be proud to announce that he was at one time the president of the Screen Actors Guild and led them on a strike. But nonetheless, what we have is a legacy of 30 years that started 30 years ago today, where under the official auspices of the government of the United States of America and the leader of the free world in those days, Ronald Reagan, took it upon himself to use the very, very significant power of his high office to break a union, and in so doing, sent a message to the corporate world that it's okay, that it's safe, that it's appropriate to strip workers of their right to have a voice at the workplace.
You know, in some of the research I was doing today, I came across a couple of articles that pointed out that from 1962 to 1981, the exact same thing that happened with the Patco workers had happened 39 times in the past. You had these federal government agencies workers saying, look, you know, we've got problems. We need to solve these. They stopped working. And in those 39 instances, those presidents chose to work with them. In this instance, as you've pointed out, for, I believe, purely political means, he chose to fire those 15,000 people, and not only fire them, but ban them for life.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And some of those other instances that you mentioned were things that had to do with real and meaningful, significant impact on national security. Multiple times, those involved workers that were directly or indirectly involved in the defense and intelligence community. And they didn't get banned for life. They didn't get fired for exercising their rights to have a voice at work. But Reagan, in his zest and his zeal for pursuing a polarizing political agenda that was aimed at elevating one group of people in this otherwise free country in which all people are created equal to a divided nation, did pursue this and pursued it for obvious, notorious, and candidly grotesque political purposes. But in so doing, had an impact that I don't even think Reagan ever dreamed of, that resulted in so many political leaders misquoting him and so many private industries really confusing their role in society from doing whatever it is the business was or is that they're supposed to be doing to instead being in the business of breaking unions and extolling the truly believed on their part, demonizing effect of unions on an American society as if somehow or another unions are illegitimate. It was Reagan and Reagan's destruction of the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization that started us down this dastardly path, and we haven't hit the end of this road yet.
As I remember this in the reading that I have done, this strike was, and Reagan points it out in his speeches that it's not about money. They've got a very lucrative contract. It was about safety. This was really their, and I've read, takes on it that there was an agreement between the White House and the Patco Union that they would do this. They would have X amount of time and it would draw attention, but, this went horribly awry.
Oh, that's absolutely right. These folks were not engaging in the collective bargaining process or in the exercise of their right. Imagine their right to withhold their labor. Reminded, of course, that it was in 1865, not 1981, that we abolished slavery in this country.
But what do you say to the law and order types then?
It was over safety issues. I'm sorry. What do you say to the law and order types about what?
Who say that, the strike was illegal, that, federal workers are not allowed to go on strike. What do you say to them?
Well, I say to them that there are any number of things that the government of the United States does that are illegal. And we have a method by which to deal with that. We have a judicial system. We are a country of laws, not a country of men. And what Reagan did was resort to something else, to self-help. If the labor organization or its members were doing something that was contrary to law, there was a method by which to handle that, as it had been handled 39 other times in the history of the then recent history of the United States, the 18, 20 years between the dates that you mentioned. But The law and order is baloney. That was law run amok and disorder imposed at the highest levels of our nation, because in doing what he did, in terminating the employment and banning for life the good, loyal, highly trained, attentive members of the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, they compromised not only well-being of those 15,000 people, but the safety and security of an entire nation, because some of us flew and those who weren't flying were on the ground underneath all the planes that were flying overhead. And, you know, if you want to create some semblance of fealty to law and order, you don't take matters into your own hands. You don't engage in self-help.
And some of the reports I read from the time, they had 19 different courts going after trying to get these people back to work. They went and they froze their strike fund. They did everything they could possibly do to make things miserable for these folks. But at the end of the day, it was still Reagan who came out and said, that's it, you're done, and you're never coming back.
Yeah, well, you know, they weren't satisfied with merely exercising the law. They needed to do something else. I mean, this is the story of, you know, somebody accidentally hits your car, and instead of resolving it with an insurance claim, you get out of your car and you punch him in the nose. You know, or worse, you have the road rage deal where somebody reaches into their glove box and pulls out a weapon and starts firing. That's self-help. That's what Reagan did. And in so doing, invited the business community, the business roundtable crowd, the big business people, to deal in kind with labor organizations. And the saddest piece of all is that in doing this, the ultimate result for the last 30 years has been an open and notorious messaging effort to delegitimize unions, labor organizations, worker organizations in the United States of America, in the freest country in the land, on the planet, so to speak. Labor unions' existence is questioned with respect to the legitimacy of the right of our organization to exist. And that's all because of Ronald Reagan and his action toward the professional air traffic controllers at a time when the rule of law was simply not satisfactory to the leader of the free world.
And, you know, I look at the situation today, Irwin, and the number of stories that I've been reading as we hear air traffic controllers are now back in the news, the working conditions that they work under, alone in towers by themselves overnight, which I think is just unconscionable and stupid. But, you know, we're seeing more and more of this, hearing stories of people having to work at the airport bar or the airport store before they go do their shift as an air traffic controller, because the wages have been falling since this period so badly.
Well, it's not only that. I mean, it's this attitude that when you put people to work in untenable, intolerable conditions, and something predictable happens, that the answer is you throw those poor schnooks under the bus who have already been demeaned and undignified and depaid, if you will, instead of blaming the managers who are responsible for creating these situations in the first place and blaming the politicians, in the case of the air traffic control system, who have chosen to do otherwise. Now, here we are 30 years later. The FAA is temporarily out of existence. And airlines today are still charging people the FAA-based taxes on airline tickets, even though there's no statutory basis upon which to collect the tax, and there's no place into which the tax must be paid. And nobody is speaking up and demanding that the airlines return that money to their customers, at least during this period of time when the FAA is not operative and the taxes are exclusively earmarked for the FAA, and are not being collected by the government.
And in fact, just the opposite of what you said. In fact, Eric Cantor was on TV today, and he said, asked that very question: why are they raising the prices? They're putting it at their bottom line. And Cantor said, we're gonna keep it towards our bottom line. And he says, I guess that's what business does. If the federal government isn't going to collect the money, these private for-profit companies are going to put it in their pocket. And I've been making the argument that if we give them tax breaks, if we give more deregulation, it's not going to save we the consumers anything. It's going to fatten their bottom lines.
Well, if ever we needed proof of exactly what this means, we're getting it right now.
Yep.
And here's Eric Cantor, that great protector of the taxpayers, saying it's okay for a company, a perfectly private company, to, under the guise of taxation, steal our money. And he, as a leader of our government, is not only not going to do anything about it, he's going to encourage it and acquiesce in it.
Yep. And what's even more perverse is the fact that Delta Airlines, in my opinion, is one of the people who are pushing this the most through their lobbyist efforts to continue to make sure that workers don't have their rights to organize.
Well, it's the same Delta Airlines that decided to acquiesce in a demand of the government of Saudi Arabia to not permit anybody with an Israeli passport or an Israeli stamp in another country's passport from being on any flight that Delta flies through or that even touches down in Saudi Arabia. So, you know, we know who they're loyal to.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. You know, you're looking at the fact that 4,000 FAA employees out in the streets. I've seen reports of 90 to 200,000 private sector workers now out in the street because the projects that they were working on, the funding is gone, has stopped until this reauthorization happens. All those folks.
And the Congress, of course, went home for recess under the leadership of John Boehner.
Yep. Took their five-week vacation.
Yeah.
But now all those people on the unemployment rolls. And we've got a legislature here in Pennsylvania that wants to destroy unemployment compensation.
Yep. It's an amazing confluence of circumstances. It wasn't good enough for the lunatic fringe to restrict eligibility and limit benefits without anything being done to deal with solvency issues as recently as a hair over a month ago at the end of June. When they did exactly that, when they created for the first time in the history of the unemployment compensation system in this state an offset for severance pay that people earn over their working life and don't get until they've lost their jobs, created for the first time a variable duration of unemployment compensation benefits so that not everybody would be entitled to the minimum 26 weeks. Some people would go down as low as 18 weeks in this state. They are back again, and next week they're having hearings, and the hearings are over a piece of legislation that would make two more eligibility changes, huge eligibility changes in unemployment compensation. One would deny people benefits when they are forced to quit a job because of the conduct of an employer, whether it's the conduct of an employer in the context of providing unsafe conditions, or the conduct of an employer with gender-based harassment, or the conduct of an employer with respect to discrimination against people who are pregnant, and also would prohibit benefit eligibility for people in this economy who lose their jobs and have to follow a spouse to another community when the spouse is able to get some work. And the other change they propose, from 1934, when the unemployment compensation law was originally adopted, until now, there has been a fundamental and basic presumption in the unemployment compensation statute that it's a remedial statute. And because it's a remedial statute, applicants for benefits are presumed to be eligible unless there's a specific statutory prohibition on benefit eligibility.
So,
and there are only a handful of those prohibitions. One is participation in a strike. And by the way, Pennsylvania is relatively unique in having that particular prohibition. Our neighbor, New York, for example, does not deny unemployment compensation benefits to strike participants. Another is voluntarily quitting your work for other than a necessitous and compelling reason. And the third is when one loses his or her job because of being engaged in willful misconduct. And the proposal about which there's going to be a legislative hearing next week on August 9th, Rick, is to change that willful misconduct to only merely misconduct. So whatever an employer says is misconduct, like coming to work on time, if the employer says that that's misconduct, they would have a right to terminate your employment, and the state would be forced to deny you unemployment compensation benefits.
Well, it's all about getting as many people off of it, cheating as many people as possible, and really creating that desperation class that I...
Well, but it's creating the desperation class without doing anything about the root of the problem. Employers, as I've said on this show in the past, are paying the exact same amount in unemployment compensation funding taxes today that they paid a quarter of a century ago. A quarter of a century ago, when they paid that amount, it represented a payment on 50% of the statewide average annual wage. Today, it's not even 19% of the statewide average annual wage. And so they have gotten a breathtaking tax cut. A breathtaking tax cut.
Yep.
And they haven't funded the system, and their answer to not funding the system is to slash and burn. Wow. Slash and burn and strip people of their right to the dignity of not having to be on the dole.
So let me ask you a last question I've got. What do we do to stop this? How do we right this ship and do the right thing here?
We recognize that this country and this state have some moral imperatives, that we will historically be judged by how we treat people and how we deal with the folks who have needs. Not, as I've said before, what do we do to make sure those who have get more, but what we do to make sure that those who do not have at least get enough. And we need to speak out. We need to contact our representatives and our state senators and let them know that this is not for Pennsylvania, that we need to educate our children. We need to do something about jobs. We need to invest in work, not in unemployment. We need to do things that encourage the creation of jobs, and that at the same time recognize that people have dignity at work. I know of no one in nearly 40 years of being a professional in labor management relations, I have yet to meet the first person who was happy about being unemployed, who sought to not have work, who wanted to be at home when their kids leave for school in the morning and still be there when their kids come home in the afternoon. Yep. Because there was no work.
I hear you, and I'm right there with you. That's why I suggest we all contact our representatives. I've got mine on speed dial. Irwin, it's always great talking with you. I look forward to having you back next week.
I'll be happy to be there. And listen, we got to start to have your listeners who are subscribers to XM and Sirius Radio start contacting XM and Sirius and say they ought to have a show on like the Rick Smith show on Sirius XM.
That's what we need to start doing. Irwin, I appreciate the time, brother.
Thank you. Take care. Good to talk to you, and we'll talk to you again next week.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Stealing is wrong, right? If you do the crime, the old slogan says, you do the time. But does everyone? Let's suppose that you robbed a Wells Fargo branch bank and scooted away with $5,000. Alas, you get caught. But you cut a deal with prosecutors. Naturally, you'd make restitution, paying back the $5K, plus you agree to a $500 fine. In return, you don't have to go to jail or even admit guilt. Plus, you're allowed to issue a press release blaming the wrongdoing not on you, but on a relatively small group of rogue cells in your brain. What are the chances of a prosecutor or Wells Fargo letting you get away with such a punishment? Zero. But if it's Wells Fargo doing the crime, such coddling is the norm in our so-called justice system. Indeed, the financial giant was caught illegally tricking thousands of lower-income families into taking out predatory home loans with exploding interest rates that eventually would cost the families thousands of dollars each and their homes. The bankers merrily falsified mortgage documents, and the bank raked in billions of dollars. It was a widespread illegality fostered by Wells Fargo's top executives. So, on July 21st, prosecutors handed down justice to these miscreant bankers. Their punishment? An $85 million fine and a $20 million restitution payment, or 0.001% of this behemoth's annual revenues of $80 billion. Far from jail time, no Wells Fargo banker was even charged, nor did the giant have to admit guilt. A corporate press release blamed the unpleasantness on a relatively small group of low-level employees. This is Jim Hightower saying, do the bankers and prosecutors think we don't see this gross injustice? Banker thievery by Wells Fargo and its ilk will not stop until top bankers are made to do the time. To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Everything's raisin, but the weight is. Everything's raisin, but the weight is. Gasoline, groceries, and our hazes. Everything's raisin, but the weight is.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Well, the Borowitz Report, fresh from the Tea Party's triumph in the recent debt ceiling fight. Tea Party favorite Michelle Bachmann set the stage for another budget-cutting battle today, proposing that the federal government slash half of the alphabet over the next 4 years. That's right. She said the days of living large with 26 letters in the alphabet are over. Anyone who watches Wheel of Fortune knows vowels are not free. If the Tea Party proposal becomes law, the United States will have to make do with only 13 letters by as early as 2015, according to Michelle Bachmann. The push to slash letters from the alphabet already has broad support among the Tea Party faithful, who find the overabundance of letters an annoyance when it comes to composing protest signs. Representative Bachmann said that there would be tremendous cost savings with the 13-letter alphabet, or AFBET, as she called it. With fewer letters, she said, we would have fewer books, fewer schools, and lower taxes. She went on to say that although we will have no taxes, at all once we eliminate the letter X. Critics of the plan say it goes too far, since cutting the letter X would eliminate not only the word taxes, but the entire state of Texas. But for his part, Texas Governor Rick Perry seemed unfazed by that possibility, saying, I'd be proud to be governor over the great state of T's. That's right, great state of T's. So there you go, your Borowitz report. How many people have heard the name Sotheby? Have you ever heard Sotheby's? You ever heard of that, Jake?
Yes, I have.
What do you think of when you hear that name, when you hear Sotheby's? What do you think?
A product made that's a classic.
Yeah, I see. Personally, I think unbridled greed, elitist excess, extreme avarice. That's what I think. And you know, you
aristocratic, perhaps.
There you go. There's another one. When I think of Sotheby's, I also think of Christie's. And if you remember, we talked about Christie's last week, one of the auctioneers who talked about in 1990 when he auctioned off a Van Gogh for $82.5 million, which was a world record at the time. He talked about how he wanted to walk off the stage because the crowd of bidders were applauding for five straight minutes. And they weren't applauding for the painting. They weren't applauding for the work of art or for Van Gogh. They were applauding for the money, greed, excess, avarice. And now Sotheby's is in the news for a different reason. And we're seeing this across the country. It's almost becoming an epidemic. Sotheby's has locked out over 40 of their union art handlers, and they're demanding that these workers take massive, major concessions. Now, is Sotheby's, are they struggling? Are they having a tough time making ends meet? Are the rich people not having enough money to buy enough art? No, no. In fact, their gross profits, over $680 million. Records. They're doing fabulously well. You know what? They want to do more. They want to be fabulously more wealthy. And again, you know, you look at these people, they have locked these folks out. They're having their contract negotiation. And since the workers won't take what they're given, they're summarily dismissed, and now they're going to start replacing them with scabs. And again, you know, we need to have that conversation about scabs in our environment. You look at what's going on, you know, down in Marietta, Pennsylvania here, where they're locked out at the Armstrong World Industries. They decided, well, you know, we're going to lock you out. You're not going to take what we're given? Lock you out. And in fact, we're going to bring in scabs, and we're going to pay them less than we were paying you. The unionized workers, they make about $18 an hour. Scabs, they're bringing them in buses with armed guards for $12 an hour with no benefits. Who in their right mind would get on a bus where you needed armed guards to go to a crummy job that's going to kick you to the curb once they settle their contract? And they've already said, we're kicking you to the curb once it's done. And I look in, again, you know, another story. You look at North Dakota. The workers at the American Crystal Sugar Factory in Moorhead, North Dakota. They went to work on Monday. Guess what? Gates locked. The employer said, sorry, you're not going to take what we're giving you. We're not going to take the screw job you're getting. You're locked out. 1,300 workers at that plant. They've got 6 other plants. All of them locked out. You won't take what we're giving you? There's the door. And it's not about money. This one with the sugar people, it's not about money. It's about subcontracting. It's about having a little job security. It's about saying, you know what, if I agree to a contract that gives me a decent wage but doesn't guarantee that I have a job for that wage, what's the point of having that? If I'm going to agree to a contract where they're going to bring somebody else in to do the work cheaper, or, you know, bring a whole bunch of people in to do the work that I could do and kick me to the curb, what's the point in agreeing to the contract? Now, look, overwhelmingly, these workers are standing together, and this is the thing I think corporate America is not really getting their head around just yet. You had more than 1,200 people, and about 97% of them voted. 97% of the people voted. Anybody who knows anything about union elections knows 97% is phenomenal. I mean, it's almost unheard of. 96% of them shot down the contract. People standing together. You look down the road here in Marietta there, where they're locking these people out at Armstrong World. They haven't had anybody cross the picket line. And down near Lancaster, I mean, in what you would not consider a union hotbed, these people are standing together. And I think you're going to start seeing more and more of this across the country as these employers continue to go after workers and continue to try and steal from them. You know, like we were talking about the other day, that J.P. Morgan Chase analyst, who is spot on, says, you know, corporations haven't been this profitable since the 1960s. And why is that? Well, they concluded that it was because they were stealing wages, they were stealing benefits, and they had a desperation class of workers who were just thankful to have a job. So what you get here is you get these employers, and here are 3 instances of employers going, you know what? Economic times are bad. Now it's time for us to go back and get all those wage gains that those workers fought for, and to get all those benefit gains that those workers fought for, take some of that pension money back. Opportunists they are. You got to give them credit. At least they're predictable. And you look at this study that came out by Bruce Western. He's a guy at Harvard University. His conclusion: unions are the great equalizer. They're the equalizing force in the labor market. They're the ones who say, you know what, we want a part of that profit. He writes in his piece, from 1973 to 2007, wage inequality in the private sector increased more than 40% among men and about 50% among women, which means you're starting to see this massive gap. He says that deunionization, the decline in the percentage of the labor force in a union, and educational stratification each explain about 33% of the rise in within group wage inequality among men, and in women about 20%. And, you know, his premise is, look, you know, as the number of people in unions have dropped, the wages have fallen. See, when you had a large number of people in labor unions, it was bringing the wages up. Now that you don't have the numbers, it's bringing the wages down. So in the past, union workers were bringing up the non-union workers. You know, it was this system. We were going to bring our brother, we're going to reach back, and you're going to bring them up. What's going on now, since there aren't enough union members to bring the wage up, the non-union sector is bringing everyone down. And that's why you're seeing this massive push to right to work. This whole no works at right agenda that the right and, you know, our buddy Mad Cow here in Pennsylvania is trying to ram through. So the more we see this, the more you have to understand, this is them trying to destroy what's left of the working middle class in this country. And they want to return us back to the good old days, the back of the feudal days, where you had a few overlords and then you had a massive desperation class. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
The Rick Smith Show.
With a PSECU home equity line of credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got our rates so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer's a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing light is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pseCU.com/light.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask me, Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
You know, you look at this situation, and the reality is, I've been saying for the longest time, I don't think things are going to change until people are desperate, until they're hungry, until their stomachs are empty. When you have nothing left to lose, that's when people come around and go, I got nothing left to lose. There's still a lot to be lost yet, I think, for working people. And, which is why you don't see many strikes anymore. You don't see people willingly going on strike. What you see are a lot of these lockouts where the companies are going, fine, I know you're not willing to strike, and I know it's gonna hurt you. I know it's gonna destroy your family. I know it's probably gonna put you into bankruptcy, but we're gonna kick you to the curb because you're not coming around to our way of thinking. And that's what these lockouts are about. It's about punishing these people for, one, organizing, and two, actually having the audacity that they can think that they have the ability to bargain collectively. That's really the thing here. And, you know, as the years have gone by, we keep looking at less and less resistance. You know, when I was a kid, I was raised with the theory that you question authority. You always question authority. And you don't, when I was a kid, I didn't take anything from anyone. In fact, you know, I go back to the story where a supervisor poked me in the chest one time. I told him, you do that again, I'm going to knock you out. He did it again, and I knocked him out. That was just then. I look at now, and this guy, Bruce Levine, he's written an excellent piece over at Alternet, titled, 8 Reasons Young Americans Don't Fight Back and How the U.S. Crushed Youth Resistance. And, you know, as I'm reading through this, he's spot on. The first thing we did is we saddled them with massive student loan debt. Because when you've got a large debt hanging over your head, you don't have time. You don't have, and mandating that they pay it back. I mean, that's the part. You can never get rid of student loan debt. Never. No bankruptcy judge can write it off. It is like you, it is with you forever like herpes. And, you know, that's a pretty powerful thing. When you get out of college, you're $25,000, $30,000 in debt, $100,000 in debt. That's a pretty sizable pain. And you look at the fact that through the years, what's been going on is we've been medicating our students. How many kids went through school with on Ritalin or on some kind of psychopathological drug, if you will? We've been medicating our kids to be compliant. This guy writes, he says, you know, schools educate compliance, not democracy. They educate you to follow on the same line, never question authority. I was just the opposite. And you look at these programs like No Child Left Behind and Race to the Top, all of this corporatocracy in the classroom. It's got our youth thinking in the corporate model. And I agree with this guy. We've shamed young people who take education, but not their schooling seriously. You know, education is what you're there for. Schooling is something different. And, you know, I think about the quote from Mark Twain. You know, he said, I never let my schooling get in the way of my education. You learn something every day. And a couple of the other things that he put in here real quick, this whole idea of normalizing surveillance. You know, from the very young age, I mean, my daughters know where the video camera, my daughter knows where the video cameras are in the school. She's used to it. She's used to being photographed. She's used to being, having IDs. She's used to standing in line and being watched. I'm still uncomfortable about that, and I feel radical about that. And the fact that we've used television as a babysitter for this generation, more so than mine. And the last thing he writes about is fundamentalist religion and this fundamentalist consumerism, where it's really taken over their lives, and it's destroying self-reliance. It's destroying the individualism. We're now got this groupthink thing going. And next week we're going to talk with Bruce Levine about this because, you know, I think he's onto something here, every bit of this. Because I often ask questions, Jake, you know, why aren't people complaining that they're putting up cameras everywhere? Why aren't people complaining when they put their kids on Ritalin? You know, why have we become this marginal line compliant society? I don't know. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about this low power FM thing that's coming up. And this is an outstanding opportunity, I think, for community groups, for progressive groups, for folks who just want to take back a portion of the media in their little part of the world to do so. The window, I guess, is going to open up sometime next year, but when we talk with Jeff Russett, the national organizer for Prometheus Radio, he's going to walk us through this. And I guess, you know, my early indications, not overly expensive. A small community group could easily raise enough money, I think, to do this. But you know what? You have this ability to talk to people. You have this ability to put out a message, this wonderful ability to communicate with your friends and neighbors and maybe get away from the corporate-controlled for-profit media. Maybe get away from those six multinational corporations who control 80% of everything we see, hear, and read. When we come back, Jeff Rossett, national organizer for Prometheus Radio Project, right back after this.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. In Michigan, public opinion is running against Republican Governor Snyder for his slash-and-burn budget and deep cuts to education. The Michigan Education Association says while Snyder succeeded in pushing the cuts through, his victory may be short-lived.
Doug Cunningham reports.
The Michigan Senate has approved Republican Governor Rick Snyder's slashing of public education funding, more than $1 billion in cuts affecting all levels of Michigan public education. The cuts, though, are highly unpopular with the people of Michigan, according to polls. Michigan Education Association spokesman Doug Pratt says the Republican action is not the last word on public education funding in Michigan.
It's not really a done deal until the voters have a chance to react, and they're going to react. Polling shows that the public is incensed about this, and they're going to make their voices heard in November of 2012, if not sooner. The governor's approval rating has gone through the floor. The governor has said repeatedly that that's not something he's worried about. The lawmakers who have to run for re-election in November of 2012 are going to start to care very much.
Unemployment insurance programs are under attack. So far in the first half of 2011, 10 states have placed new restrictions or deep cuts on how unemployment is collected. The National Employment Law Project released a study this week finding 6 states had slashed the maximum number of weeks unemployment insurance can be claimed to less than 26. That number of weeks has been the standard in every state of the union for more than 50 years. Michigan, one of the states hardest hit by the employment crisis, cut the available weeks to 20. Missouri and South Carolina did the same. Florida has placed their unemployment benefits on a sliding scale. The higher the unemployment rate in the state, the more weeks available. If the unemployment rate in Florida slips down to 5%, only 12 weeks of unemployment can be claimed. Indiana has changed the way it calculates benefits. The average unemployment benefits will drop by $63 starting in July of 2012. Only 2 states, Colorado and Rhode Island, have addressed the unemployment insurance solvency issue by raising and indexing the taxable wage base. Many states instead chose to offer tax breaks to employers. The project is calling on the federal government to intervene. In their study, they proposed 3 possible relief solutions. One of the solutions is a proposal by Senator Dick Durbin and offers to waive federal interest payments on trust fund borrowing for 2 years, delay federal unemployment tax increases, and forgives up to 60% of state loans if states agree not to cut programs.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News.
Your working class radio experience. Where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. You know, for the longest time, I've been saying we need to take our media back. We need alternative opportunities. We need people to be owning radio stations, not multinational corporations. The last statistic I saw, 80% of everything we see, hear, and read owned by 6 multinational corporations. That is not healthy for democracy. Not at all, which is why I think the folks over at Prometheus Radio Project are doing an outstanding service to our country. That's why I've asked Jeff Rousset, the national organizer for Prometheus Radio Project, to come talk to us. Jeff, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick. Thanks for having me on the show.
I appreciate it. You know, explain a little bit about what Prometheus Radio Project does.
Sure. So for the last 10 years, Prometheus Radio Project has been fighting corporate ownership over the media and corporate domination of the media, such as what you were talking about with 80% of everything we see and hear and read now coming from a handful of corporations. So one of the ways we've done that is we have successfully sued the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, when they tried to allow corporations to own and consolidate even larger shares of the media market. Another way we've done that has been by advocating for community radio stations, which are non-commercial radio stations controlled by nonprofits and community groups, so that ordinary people, like you're saying, can have a slice of the airwaves, a way to tell our own stories. And so we successfully have done both those things, and most recently, actually, just this January, we successfully passed the Local Community Radio Act into law, which mandates the FCC to issue thousands of new community radio stations all across the country, including for the first time in big cities. So this is a tremendous opportunity for ordinary people, for workers, for immigrants, for, you know, veterans, soldiers, and youth, and groups that have been traditionally excluded from mainstream corporate media to own the media, to control the means of production, the means of producing media, and to tell our own stories and to use media as a tool for organizing our communities and fighting for the issues that, that we care about in our communities.
Right. You know, too much of what we hear, and I talk about this often, too much of what we hear is the corporate message, the constant drumbeat of, you know, good corporation, bad government, good corporation, bad unions, just a constant drumbeat of this message. You know, I guess, you know, the Glenn Becks and the Rush Limbaughs can say all the crazy things they want as long as they're preaching anti-government, as long as they're preaching pro-corporate.
Right, and that's certainly a shallow analysis, to say the least. You know, to say that the government is, you know, doing everything bad, and not to look at the corporations that are actually controlling the government, and that actually, you know, pretty literally have bought virtually all of our politicians, and really made politicians servants of that corporate agenda.
Yeah, you know, I hear often, and I get people telling me all the time, Rick, you know, what you talk about in your program, I don't hear anybody else saying. All I'm hearing is this. And that's one of the reasons we started this program, but there are so few outlets for us to take our program, and we've had people go, well, why aren't you expanding? Because they're not there. And I think this is an opportunity for not just our program, but for anyone in their community who wants to have a discussion and to build something locally for their own community, and to begin to take back some of the message and fight back against the globalization, and fight back against the corporatocracy that seems to be taking over our nation.
Mm-hmm.
So walk me through this. How do we, you know, let's say I'm a small community group. Me and my friends want to start a radio station. How would we go about this? I understand the window is going to be opening soon. Walk me through a little bit of that.
Yeah, so we expect that the deadline to apply for these stations may come as soon as June 2012. Right now, the Federal Communications Commission is writing the rules that will determine how many stations are available and where they become available. So right now, we are asking groups who want stations to go to our website, PrometheusRadio.org, and through there you can take action to send comments to the FCC telling them that we want radio stations available in our communities. When you go to PrometheusRadio.org, you can also click the button that says I want to start a radio station, and we'll put you on our mailing list and keep you informed about when the application will be made available, and also steps that you can take right now to organize your community and to prepare for running your own station. So I would direct everybody to PrometheusRadio.org, and there, you know, we've got all the steps for communicating with the FCC, filing comments with them, and also getting plugged into webinars, conference calls, email list, discussion listservs, and all these resources that we have for groups who want to start stations. Because not only did we advocate to expand community radio, but, you know, what we're doing is really working closely with groups that want to start stations to work with them through that process to make sure that groups get on the air. And, you know, the best way to get plugged in is by going to PrometheusRadio.org.
And we've got a link at our site at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on Jeff Rousset's name. It'll take you right there. Let's talk a little bit about how this works. I mean, you're talking about starting a radio station. It seems pretty, pretty overwhelming, pretty daunting task, and costly. Can you walk me through, you know, maybe some of the costs? Because as I understand, it's not as costly as we may think.
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah. I mean, these these stations are low power FM community radio stations, which means that they operate at 100 watts and they essentially can cover about a 10-mile radius. The equipment and the costs are much simpler and much more affordable than larger scale radio stations, and it's very localized. So we're telling folks that estimated startup costs for a low power community radio station like this can be anywhere between $10,000 to $25,000 to get the broadcasting equipment, the antenna, all the kind of technology that you need. One of the things that's great about this is that you don't need to buy your own building to do this. If you have space, if you have a building, you can turn one of the existing rooms into your studio to operate out of there. You know, costs will vary depending on whether you know how many volunteers you have versus how many staff members you have, also, groups need to have nonprofit status to take advantage of this opportunity. And for groups that don't have that, you can partner with nonprofits to do that. And then again, some more of the recurring costs are like paying rent for whatever building it's in, paying staff members, and you can also get equipment donated, which will also lower some of the costs for you.
And you guys,
application itself is free. And after you apply, you have up to 3 years to build a station. So you don't need to have all that money up front, but you can take time to fundraise and to build your capacity to be able to afford it and run this project.
And you guys at Prometheus Radio Project, you'll help walk folks through all of that as it comes up. The upfront cost, the application cost, as you've said, doesn't cost anything for the application, but there are some charges along the way, some engineering costs. Yes, no?
Yeah, engineering studies can cost like from $500 to $3,000. And we are, we're also working to organize engineers around the country who are familiar with this to donate some of their services to groups who really can't afford to pay those costs. But what it comes down to is for groups that want to start a station like this, they're going to have to fundraise and work to collect those resources that it takes, because it's not going to be free. It's not going to be easy, but we do think that it's worth it, especially for groups that have some capacity to take something like this on, and then to be able to partner with other groups that may not have the resources available to get those voices on the air.
It is the ultimate in community organizing. It is the ultimate of bringing people together. And this is, one of the things that I'm hoping some folks in the area are going to think about and take up, because as you pointed out, as early as next June, we could be seeing that window open, and when it opens, it closes awful fast.
That's right. Yeah, we think that the actual deadline may be next June. Groups really need to get mobilized right now to figure out what their fundraising plans are going to be, and how to collaborate with other groups in their region, because, like you said, community radio is not just about radio and the technology, but it's really about building that community.
Yep. And the website, again, is PrometheusRadio.org. We've got a link on our site at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Jeff Rousset's name. It'll take you right there. Jeff, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much for the information.
Thank you so much, Rick.
All right. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Stealing is wrong, right? If you do the crime, the old slogan says, you do the time. But does everyone?
Let's suppose that you robbed a Wells Fargo branch bank and scooted away with $5,000. Alas, you get caught. But you cut a deal with prosecutors. Naturally, you'd make restitution, paying back the $5K, plus you agree to a $500 fine. In return, you don't have to go to jail or even admit guilt. Plus, you're allowed to issue a press release blaming the wrongdoing not on you, but on a relatively small group of rogue cells in your brain. What are the chances of a prosecutor or Wells Fargo letting you get away with such a punishment? Zero. But if it's Wells Fargo doing the crime, such coddling is the norm in our so-called justice system. Indeed, the financial giant was caught illegally tricking thousands of lower-income families into taking out predatory home loans with exploding interest rates that eventually would cost the families thousands of dollars each and their homes. The bankers merrily falsified mortgage documents, and the bank raked in billions of dollars. It was a widespread illegality fostered by Wells Fargo's top executives. So, on July 21st, prosecutors handed down justice to these miscreant bankers. Their punishment? An $85 million fine and a $20 million restitution payment, or 0.001% of this behemoth's annual revenues of $80 billion. Far from jail time, no Wells Fargo banker was even charged, nor did the giant have to admit guilt. A corporate press release blamed the unpleasantness on a relatively small group of low-level employees. This is Jim Hightower saying, do the bankers and prosecutors think we don't see this gross injustice? Banker thievery by Wells Fargo and its ilk will not stop until top bankers are made to do the time.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone, by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
I was going to go to work, but then I got... I just got a new promotion, but I got...
Well, yeah, I got to say, I like the song. I think it's funny. I don't think most people get it, though. The South Park reference, not sure. Anyway, the Borowitz Report talking about Joe Biden, Vice President Joe Biden, ignited an international incident when he called the Tea Party terrorists, causing the leader of Al-Qaeda to demand an apology. Just moments after Biden made his controversial comments, Al-Qaeda chief Ahmed al-Zuhari appeared in a video to condemn the comment, which the terrorist called hurtful. He said, I demand that Vice President take back his offensive comment immediately, said al-Zuhari in the video broadcast on Al Jazeera. It is bad, very bad for our brand. Mr. Biden attempted to clarify his remarks later in the day, telling reporters, I in no way intended to insult members of Al-Qaeda. Both Al-Qaeda and the Tea Party tried to destroy the U.S. economy. Biden elaborated, but in fairness to Al-Qaeda, the Tea Party came much closer. And, true. I don't know if you saw this, but the Obama administration rolled out its new strategy to counter U.S. radicalization today. According to reports, the strategy will focus on working with state and local governments, non-governmental and community organizations to hone in on countering extremist ideology, enhancing social cohesion, and building resiliency within American communities. How's that possible when you have the T-twits running around? It's been reported also that there are at least 10 lawyers advising Mitt Romney's presidential campaign who have worked in and around the Bush White House, including a guy named Stephen Bradbury. He is the former Office of Legal Counsel head who signed the torture memos approving waterboarding. And, of course, a number of other torture techniques as well. And according to Romney's spokesperson, Mitzi supports using those techniques in certain situations. So, you know, I started thinking about this. You know, you got Mitzi going, well, in certain situations, and it's that whole ticking bomb thing. We got the ticking clock. Tick, 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 tick. You know, the terrorist groups are coming. The ideology of the extremists are coming to destroy us. The bomb is about to attack. We've got to do whatever we need to do to do away with the threat. And I was starting to think about the debt. They took us right to the wire. The ticking bomb, the economy's going to explode. The globe is going to go down with our debt. And I started to think about it. You know, as it's going, tick, 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 here we are being held hostage. You know, I can just hear it now. The nation has mere hours before the debt deadline. The nation held hostage at the mercy of American hating madmen. The clock is ticking. What do we do? We bring buckets of water into Congress with rags. We waterboard the teabaggers. Perfect. Maybe that's what Romney's got on his mind. Fortunately, it didn't have to come to that. But, you know, I could just see it. You know, if that's the point, there you go. Did you see this the other day, Jake? Evidently, Newt Gingrich has 1.3 million Twitter followers. The Gawker.com is saying, not so sure. They're saying that, you know, many of the Gingrich accounts are inactive or are dummy accounts created by various follow agencies. And, of course, Newt's people tweeted out there, no, our 1.3 million followers are legit. And at Gawker said, I guess prove it. And one person, you know, said that, yes, I'm real. Not only am I real, I'm with Newt. So they had one of the 1.3 million followers who decided that they would chime in.
Good for him. I'm not so sure it matters if he has one or a million. Very little chance of being president, thank goodness.
But again, you know, and he's trying to play it off. Well, you know, the media is just after me. No, you're a bad candidate. I'm amazed he got elected into Congress. But the sad reality is, as radical as he was in the 90s, I mean, as far out as we thought he was on the radical fringe in the
90s. He's a Santa Claus, didn't he?
Oh, my gosh. You know, he was a bleeding heart liberal compared to the wackos, and he's trying. He's really trying to get all the way out there, and it's just not happening for him.
I mean, there's a parallel there. I remember the Reagan days. I actually got involved when Reagan became president because of him, and I saw him. And they used to say he conducted a war against the poor, and what he did with the air traffic controllers, and it just seemed that the world was turned upside down. But comparatively. Isn't it ironic that Ronald Reagan would very much be a moderate in comparison? You could say that he's actually a liberal in the Republican Party.
There's no way
he could be elected today.
I would say he'd be seated next to Bernie Sanders.
In comparative.
I mean, how far we have gone to the right, how far.
Isn't it amazing?
The goalposts have been moved. I mean, you know, and you look at what Ian Millhiser over at Think Progress put up. President Obama has tapped Mike Lee, the senator from Utah, the insaniac, the tenther, probably one of the most radical guys in the Senate. I don't know if you saw his Mike Lee and Rand Paul's little dog and pony show over the last past weekend, but it was hysterical. It was insanity. It was who can be crazier? It was like the insane Laurel and Hardy. Evidently Obama has tapped Mike Lee's legal counsel to be the next U.S. attorney for Utah. You could not find a rational Democrat. You couldn't find a rational even Republican. You've got to pick someone from Mike Lee. And the guy's name is David Barlow. And, you know, the reality is, you know, the questions then pile up. Is this guy gonna protect seniors' rights to Social Security? And Ian Millhiser lays this out. They haven't vetted him, I don't think, well enough for this job. I mean, if I judge people by who they hang around with. If you're working for Mike Lee, I don't know that you're not too crazy off the path, too. So why would Obama do this? I have no idea why you would put a rabid right-winger as U.S. attorney in Utah. It makes almost no sense to me.
Well, the only possibility is it's a quid pro quo. He needs a big favor from somebody, which is a possibility.
I mean, this is a guy who said that, you know, federal disaster relief monies violates the Constitution. This is a guy. who said that, you know, the federal anti-poverty programs are not necessarily the role of the federal government, and they're not part of the Constitution. So you know what? You starving people? You're on your own. I talk about food safety. Government shouldn't be doing it. Child labor laws, well, you know, sorry. Constitution was designed to be a little bit harsh. So you children, get back out there and start scavengering, which is a word that came up in today's hearing over here on child labor laws. Scavengering. Are we going back to that? They want to do away with all the laws, so you're going to have kids going out there like the Breaker Boys, picking out the coal out of the conveyor belt of rocks, losing fingers, losing toes. That's where these folks want to take us back to, and yet we've got a president. And look, I voted for the guy. I did. But I look at this and I go, this is the guy who's decided that we're going to put someone like this as the U.S. attorney. Sometimes you got to wonder. And what's the politic in this? I mean, the Senate has left. They're back on vacation. And we've got numerous judicial nominees who need to be confirmed. We've got a court system that is basically gridlocked because we don't have enough people to adjudicate the cases. We don't have enough people to hear everything. And the Republicans just go, you know, we're going on vacation. Woohoo! It's spring break. It's just nuts. Yet that's where we are, folks. And the more I look at this, the more I got to ask, you know, when are we gonna put all of this aside and start saying, how's this working for working people? I look at all of these attacks, and I go, when are you going to wake up? You know, I was talking to somebody today who was telling me about the lockout down the Lancaster Way in Marietta with the Armstrong World people. And he said, you know, I'm amazed that half the people, you know, are waving the middle finger at us. I mean, these are people, and part of it makes me think that maybe nobody knows why they're out there. Maybe they don't know they're being locked out, that they were kicked to the curb. I don't know. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Erica Smiley, Jobs with Justice. There's a big conference coming up this weekend we're going to head to in Washington, D.C., hoping to take part in that. We're going to bring you some stuff back next weekend, right back after this.
Money, it's a gas.
Smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
My name is Joanna, and my job is to protect children, to help them live in safe and stable families. I work for you, the taxpayers, in Children and Youth Services. Every day, I help children and families in crisis. Many parents have lost their jobs, making it harder to keep a roof overhead, food on the table, and stress under control. My caseloads are huge, and waiting lists for critical services are too long. Yet I know the safety of these children depends on me. Even in tough economic times, legislators must fund these vital programs. Because if we don't help these kids now, the cost to them and to us will be much higher later on. Children don't only depend on me doing my job, they're counting on you to care about their safety. Contact your state legislators today. Demand that they invest in programs that prevent and treat child abuse, because a child in pain shouldn't have to wait.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280, or visit our website at teamsterslocal776.org. We are people helping people.
back to the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
When those Walmart guys hear the word unionize, they go completely insane. They'll find out who, and boy, if it's you, you're as far a world of fame. Yeah, I got friends with low wages. They work for
and welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Also, if you want to email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. And this weekend, we're going to be heading out to D.C. for the Jobs with Justice Conference. Going to take my 9-year-old along, an opportunity to spend a little time with my daughter and, you know, show her the some of the things that are going on there in D.C. Here to talk to us a little bit about the conference is Erica Smiley. She's with Jobs with Justice. Erica, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick. Glad to do it.
Can we talk about this weekend's conference? What's the goal and who's going to be there?
Oh, man. Well, where can I begin? This is the first time we've brought together the entire network in over 3 years. And really, the goal is try to answer the question of what this current political moment in history calls on Jobs for Justice to do. A lot has happened since 2008, since we last convened. So we're really trying to just figure out creative and innovative ways to expand the right to organize and collectively bargain.
And who are the people you're bringing together?
It's essentially it's our national network, and so you know, there are 47 local coalitions around the country that will all be mobilizing their own bases of local unions, community groups, worker centers, faith groups, student groups. Additionally, we'll probably have a lot of our national allies present as well, including some of the worker centers that have kind of grown into their own national network. So the National Domestic Workers Alliance, National Guest Workers Alliance. Groups like that will be sharing the space with us, trying to answer, tackle some of these questions.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to coming out because, you know, there's, as you pointed out, there's a lot going on. I mean, you look at Wisconsin alone, all of the attacks that have gone on there against workers' rights, the voter ID stuff, you name it, they're going after it. And the same attacks are happening here in Pennsylvania just a little bit later here in the next month and a half. We're going to see all of those things front and center right here. So it'll be interesting to see people coming together and talk about those things.
You bet. I mean, in fact, from Pennsylvania, I think we've got a group of about 12 or 15 guest workers coming from Pennsylvania who realized that they were being used as scabs in Hershey factories where the Bakers and Confectionery Workers Union had originally had members. And so they're going to be coming asking for solidarity and joining with the union to say that you can't use guest workers against union members in your own in the U.S., particularly when the unemployment rate is so high.
Yeah, walk me through some of that, because I've talked to a couple people about that, where they're abusing what, from the way I understand it, they're abusing the educational guest worker program.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that particular is the J-1 visa educational guest worker program. There are others as well, the H-2B visa, which is sometimes a low-skilled worker. I mean, the long and short is that a company shouldn't be able to exploit workers who are coming from overseas trying to have a decent life and get a decent wage at the expense of U.S. workers who are unemployed at the same time, right? And so neither worker should be exploited. And in the end, the employer is the one that ultimately gains. So recently, in fact, it was just about a month and a half ago, we had a victory in Tennessee where a company, Vanderbilt Landscaping, had, again, brought workers over from Mexico, exploited them, taken their passports, literally held them hostage in some ways on a campsite in Tennessee. And meanwhile, the surrounding county's unemployment rate was somewhere around 39%. So unemployed workers actually joined together with guest workers, not as their enemy, but in solidarity against the employer. And just about a month and a half ago, the Department of Labor debarred that company from the guest worker program.
Well, that's a good thing, but the reality is if you don't have organizations like yours out there fighting for folks, there aren't a lot of low-wage worker lobbyists in Washington or here in Harrisburg, for that matter.
Oh, you bet it. You bet it. I mean, I think Jobs for Justice in answering some of these questions and trying to figure out what our role is in this period, particularly post the convergences in Wisconsin and what happened even in the Middle East, in Egypt and Cairo, just trying to figure out what are the creative ways that we can engage and help build the movement and build unity in this way. And in some ways, it's made us harken back to our founding in that, you know, we want to obviously work with the laws that we currently have, but we don't want to be limited to those. So what are ways that we need to expand the right to organize, both in reforming the National Labor Relations Act, like we tried to do with the Employee Free Choice Act, but also maybe going beyond that after some of those legislative defeats and figuring out innovative strategies to expand the right to organize, regardless of what the current law says. And so you'll see that when you meet workers who are organizing from Walmart with an organization. They have the Organization United for Respect at Walmart, which is a rights-based group. They aren't waiting for an NLRA permission to have an election to form the union. They're going ahead and starting to organize right now so that when they hopefully get to that point, you know, they have the flexibility to choose if they want a union or not. You've got groups like the National Domestic Workers Alliance that are basically negotiating and laying out the outline for collective bargaining rights in New York State right now, first time ever that's ever happened. So I think that we're just trying to let our creative side come out a little bit at this conference, remember why we were founded, how we were founded, remember why we created things like the Workers' Rights Board to basically counteract a useless NLRB at some places, to basically go out there and say, what is it that we can do right now that's going to help bring these different movements together under the right to organize, under the ability to challenge corporate power? What is it that we can do in this political moment that's going to help build the movement
right
in the way it needs to be built?
You know, and looking at what happened in Wisconsin when we were there in February, that's what has to happen. People have to come out in the streets. We have to work together. I saw groups that I never thought I'd see marching next to each other. This is the time in history where we're going to decide which side we're on. And
absolutely.
It's groups like yours that are working to bring people together. But at the end of the day, it's going to be each one of us deciding which side in this struggle we're on.
Absolutely. I mean, the attack by the right and by corporations and by Wall Street is probably at its sharpest that we've seen in a century. And so this is definitely a which side are you on movement. And it's definitely going to take long-standing relationships and long-term coalitions like Jobs for Justice to be able to build a real fight back. I mean, the reason we had such success in Wisconsin and many instances is because a lot of those organizations, those unions, those folks were in long-term relationships with each other. And if we don't have those relationships, then we're much slower to get out to the fight. So that's why this is so important at this time.
You know, one of the things that folks point to is, I think, a big success for not only Jobs with Justice, but a whole bunch of community groups in the state of Vermont is the fact that they got a single-payer system, pushing towards a single-payer system, pushed through, even though, you know, I think Bernie took a little bit too much credit for that, but I do think that a lot of groups like yours deserve credit as well.
Well, there'll be definitely a pretty huge victory around the Vermont healthcare victory. And also, I think there'll be a lot of healthcare activists and advocates from around the country and other states who are trying to come and learn from that victory and figure out different ways to push for something similar in their own states.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Erica Smiley. She's with Jobs with Justice. Their conference this weekend in Washington, D.C., bringing people across the country together to talk about the issues facing workers on the job. And one of the things that I've been talking about is this wage theft. You know, we had someone on last night talking about child labor law and talking about the farm workers and how basically they're just getting screwed at every turn. Not only is it with child labor, it's also getting cheated out of wages, cheated out of job protections, injury protection, all of that. And I'm hoping to see some of that at your conference here this weekend.
Absolutely. There's actually an entire track called Turning the Tides on immigration enforcement. And, again, one of the things that Jobs for Justice as a network prides itself on is being a convergent site for multiple movements under the banner of expanding the right to organize for workers. And so within that, it's going to be a lot of discussion around immigration enforcement as a barrier to workers being able to fight for dignity and for their communities and families to have dignity and respect both at the job and at home. And so we'll be talking a lot about issues of wage theft in addition to E-Verify, secure communities, and other policies that the right has really implemented in our communities to try to keep immigrants from organizing and to keep us separated from each other.
If you want more information about the conference and about Jobs with Justice, jwj.org is the website. You can go to thericksmithshow.com, click on Erica Smiley's name, it'll take you right there. So what are you hoping comes out of this conference? Because I'm excited about coming. My daughter's exciting. You're going to have a children's program as well. What are you hoping comes out of this?
Well, I think that overall we're really just hoping to, one, build more unity in this period and to try to get a little more clarity as a group, collective clarity around the way forward and what we're doing. We're actually coming off of a lot of really exciting victories. The workers in Illinois, the steel workers who were locked out of the Honeywell plant, they just had a settlement. Literally, we found out today.
Yep.
At the same time, Verizon workers might be voting on a strike over the weekend. It's just a very dynamic time. And I think that our real hope of coming out of this is that we all have a very clear focus on whatever it takes to expand the right to organize for working people in this country, and how to do that in the most unified way. That's the path that we want to take.
Yeah, because I think everyone has to realize we're all in the Shark Tank together. They may not be coming after us. The shark may not be coming for us right now, but eventually it'll be our turn.
Oh, you better believe it.
Erica,
believe it, and I hope your daughter gets just as much out of it.
Yeah, we're gonna have a good time. Look forward to seeing you there at the conference in D.C. I appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick.
All righty. You know, I'm looking forward to this. I think it's going to be a great opportunity to really to network with folks and to talk about the issues that I think are really important and do some of the organizing that the networking that has to happen. There's a lot of stuff going on here in the next couple of months. There's a lot of stuff, the voter ID, the child labor laws, the no rights at work agenda, you name it, the radical right here in this state, they're going to go after it. Just that simple. Let's go to the phone lines. I got Todd on line one. How you doing tonight, Todd?
Hey, Rick. How you doing tonight?
I'm excellent. How are you?
I'm doing quite well. Thank you for asking. I just wanted to make a little comment about the topic you were talking about earlier and the free radio kind of thing. And
well, it's not free. It's low power FM. Communities buy into it and they run it themselves. They're
right. Well, you know, at least free from corporate interest radio. Let's put it that way. But I used to have a public access TV show in Columbus, Ohio called What the Hell Was That? And it was essentially just you know, me ranting for half an hour, and I loved it, had a great time doing it, had a lot of very disturbed fans. And unfortunately, the powers that be, the Democratic ones, decided they couldn't afford public access television anymore, yet they still pay $500,000 a year to put on their government channel. And, you know, I also worked in professional radio for a number of years, worked at a place called QFM 96 in Columbus, and as much as I enjoyed working in radio, I just realized that, as you were saying, you know, more and more corporations are essentially buying up all of the media. They're all owned by, you know, a handful of corporate interests. And sadly, you know, you can take it back to, Clinton's deregulation, back in the early 90s.
The telecom bill of 96?
Yeah, and you know, it's something that I think, you know, needs to be addressed. Unfortunately, you know, the pro business attitude of you know, generally the entire Republican Party and even, you know, a good bit of the Democrats don't seem to have a problem with the fact that you know, one person can, you know, own the media of you know, a quarter of the country.
Yeah, and you know, what's scaring to me is I had a guy call last night who said, you know, he didn't mind that we don't have a manufacturing base, doesn't mind that we turn into a service-based economy. And the more I'm thinking about this, the more it's been this drumbeat of conservative talk radio, of pro-business media that said, well, you know, we, service economy, that's the way we want to go. We don't really need manufacturing.
Right. We don't need to make things anymore. We can have people in China make it for 10 cents a day.
Yeah, I mean, it's a scary situation we're in right now, and I think having more voices, having more opportunity to hear a variety of thoughts and a variety of opinions, that's what democracy is about, not having the same homogenous message from coast to coast like we have now.
And, you know, not even as important as the talk radio, I'm tired of listening to The River. You know, I'm tired of hearing, you know, the same, you know, 50, 60 songs played over and over again. I want some album cuts. I want to hear some decent Van Halen. You know, I'm tired of hearing Jump.
Exactly. Exactly. I'm right there with you, Todd.
Well, yeah, I just wanted to call and say I do appreciate the fact that you are a voice of reason in this area, and certainly in Pennsylvania. We need folks like you more than ever. So keep up the good work, my friend.
I appreciate it, Todd. Thanks for listening. Thanks for the call.
Take care.
We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask Me Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you with the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You know, the president evidently is scheduling a bus tour throughout the Midwest in August. He's going to help build some support in the battleground states, according to the White House. The schedule isn't set just yet, but I'm going to guess, unlike Sarah Palin, Obama's going to tell people where he'll be and when he'll be there so that you don't have folks standing outside all day long for nothing at all. The tour will be run by the White House and not by the reelection campaign. That's an interesting thought. Let's go to the phone lines. I got Pierre on line one. How you doing tonight, Pierre?
Hello, Rick. I'm calling from Sweden in Europe.
I appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Yeah, the thing is that we in Sweden here, we watch news all the time about America and such. And the view we get over here of how the Americans are, that they are afraid of socialism and the social welfare and benefits of socialism. And since we have different political views and systems and everything, so I'm just wondering, why is it that most Americans are afraid of the socialism idea of having everyone help each other, like everyone pay taxes and everyone benefits from it? I don't understand that.
No, I'm there with you. I don't understand it either. You know, we talk about community, but we're against the idea of actually acting as a community. We talk about being one nation and country first, but yet we won't take care of our own people. I'm right with you there, Pierre.
Yeah. So living in Sweden here, we have a lot of social welfare so that all the homeless people, they get help. All the homeless children get help, and all the sick, they benefit from this. And there's actually no backdrops. Anything bad about it. So when people talk about the capitalistic system of the United States that have insurances for going to hospitals and stuff, we don't have insurances for going to hospitals. We simply go there, we pay a small fee, and then the taxpayers pay the rest of the fee to the hospitals, so you don't have to think about it. And you can even do, large surgeries by doctors for just a couple of, $30. Something like that.
Let me ask you this, Pierre. And this is kind of a rhetorical question. How many billionaires do you have?
Money?
How many billionaires?
Oh, in Sweden?
Yeah, how many billionaires?
I think we have five, six to ten people.
Yeah, see, we seem to be proud of the fact that we've got over 1,500. And that makes that there's some national pride in that. Granted, we don't have health care for 50 million people. We got 14 million people unemployed, and a good number of people are underinsured. Mm. So, but we're very proud of the fact that we've got billionaires. In fact, we seem to like to sacrifice and tighten our belt so that we can keep giving tax breaks to the millionaires and billionaires. And we can keep giving huge tax breaks to corporations because, you know what, if you're not sacrificing, you're not one of us. And that's being facetious, but the reality is that's what it seems like when you talk to some of the voters in this country. Let me ask you a couple other things while I got you on the line. Your health care system, I mean, we've heard a lot in this country about socialistic health care that, we're taxed at 1,000,000%, and, you got long lines, got to wait forever, because, of course, we've got the best health care in the world, they tell us, but if you can't afford it, you're still going to die. Let me ask you about yours. How long do you have to wait to see a doctor there?
Let's say it's an emergency. You can always call the ambulance, and then you're always in the first in line if you have, like, a really dying hope of getting into the hospital. But if it's just a small injury, I think you'll have to wait 2 to 3 hours, depending on the rush of the day, the time, and the events like Christmas or summer.
Wow, when my daughter broke her arm, I was in the emergency room 11 and a half hours before they finally
that's horrible.
Before they finished her broken arm.
So we have some of those extreme cases in Sweden as well. Old people, retired people, they often get into the emergency room and they have to wait 3 hours with a broken something, and it bleeds inside. And the only way to get attention from the medic personnel is to, like, really show them that there's blood on the floor to get them running. So if you're bleeding, you'll get help immediately. But if you're not bleeding, you're getting a phase 2 kind of wait line because you're not an emergency. You
we've
survive.
We got the same thing.
The
gunshot wounds, they get to go first. how many gunshot victims do you have in Sweden?
Very much less per capita and per percentage and amount, since Sweden is much smaller. But also we don't have the same gun laws, so you need to actually go out and use the guns if you want the guns. You need to either hunt or practice shoot or do something with the pistols other than just owning one. So you can't use one for home protection.
You just can't have an arsenal in your basement. So no arsenals. That's, for some, that's a downside. Let me ask you about education. You know, your college kids. Your college kids come out of debt $30,000, $40,000 in the hole?
Oh, yeah. After you finish the college kind of thing in Sweden, we don't have college, but we have something similar. You go on to university and like a higher school, and that is not funded by the government. That you need to borrow money from a certain government-ish, like a CSN, it's called.
Okay.
And then you borrow the money from them in, like, you repay until you're 50-plus years. Like, you have to repay every month a lot of money, $100 a month for your education. So, many people are in debt after finishing their schools.
So there's a similarity we have. We hear a lot of things about what goes on overseas, and I know Sweden has a very high standard of living.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I look at the – what about unions? How are unions viewed in Sweden?
Oh, unions is nothing bad at all. Like, you don't get fired for joining a union, but it's kind of more like a common sense thing, like, oh, you started working. Yeah, you must join a union. So it's like, why must I join a union? It's like you get the benefits of sitting in a comfy chair because the union makes them follow those rules. Because there's a lot of rules in Sweden about what kind of condition you can work in. You can't have paint everywhere. You can't have the smell of dead bodies everywhere. So like you gotta sit comfy. You gotta have a good smell in the office. You have to have good light through windows. You can't work in a basement. Like that's not a condition in Sweden.
Well,
so the union,
it sounds like two different things here. You say the comfy chair. That sounds like something one of the right wingers in our country would say. Oh well, you know, they're lazy and they don't want to work and they have to get all this stuff. But what you're really talking about are basic working conditions.
Yeah, it's like you have cubic offices in America. I've seen it a lot in movies. Like 1,000 people sit in cubic offices everywhere. We don't have it in Sweden. It's like more of a desk thing, and there's no wall. Everybody sit like so they can see each other. Most of the desks are adjustable in height, so you can just stand up if you want one day. If you don't like sitting, you can stand up, and you can sit down when you're tired. So we have a lot of those conditions. Also, we have breaks that is included in the pay as well, so you can go on break and still get paid. Also, lunch is part of like the schedule of the day.
Right. How much vacation time do you guys get?
3 weeks is Swedish standard, so everybody must get 3 weeks. If you work a lot of overtime, you can add to the hours so you can get another week or so. But the general idea is that if you pay taxes, the taxes will pay you your vacation money when you are on vacation. So it's kind of a small account, like, that stocks up with money.
Interesting.
And then when you go on vacation, you, you're
Now, last question before I have to take a break. You know, we just went through a whole big debt crisis here.
Yeah, I got an ad on the internet live stream here. So, yeah.
How's the view in Sweden of what went on in Washington, D.C. here?
The view?
Yeah. What did the people around you talk about? How do you see what happened?
About a second crisis that, oh, no, it's going to go down again. The dollar is going to drop in value, and everybody's worried about what Obama's next step is, because it's going to affect everyone. It's not just going to affect me and you. It's going to affect every single living being, except for China, maybe. I don't know. So we're kind of worried that if the dollar drops too much, prices will go hula loops, and we don't know if we can cope with that.
Well, see, it's all around the world. Pierre, I appreciate the call. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick.
Please call back again sometime.
Yes.
I look at this, and, you go back to this debt fight. Look how we're viewed around the world. But more importantly, listen to the working conditions that they have there. I mean, the reality is, while it sounded like a right-wing argument, oh, they get comfy chairs. Yeah, they don't have to, they get to have a say in what happens on the work floor. And if that means not sitting on a wooden chair that's going to hurt your back over 30 or 40 years, that's what they do. I got to be honest. Those are the kind of working conditions I'd love to have. And there's not much we can do here other than what we've been talking about, the right to organize, the right for folks to come and fight back and do the things that need to happen. So, getting an international call. Imagine that. But that's the power of the Internet. Amazing stuff. But again, I'm taken by how over there it's just commonplace. We're going to get 3 weeks vacation. We're going to get breaks. We're going to get lunches. We're going to have a voice on the job. We're not going to work in bad conditions. We're going to have a say. Just as a matter of fact. Just remarkable. Yet we seem to think, wow, we're going to work, more hours. Like this child labor bill that they were debating, that they had a hearing for today. Talking about letting children work more hours during the school year, work more hours during the summer, and the fact that they want to move from the 16 to 18-year-olds to be able to work 48 hours instead of 40 makes me go, what's the point in having a 40-hour work week? Oh, yeah, you got to pay them overtime, but we're talking about kids. Not to mention, we're talking about an environment where you've got some 14 million people unemployed, and yet we're going to work children longer? Doesn't make an awful lot of sense to me. What it tells me is we're going backwards. We're reverting to the days of, children working in factories and children working in coal mines. And that's the whole reason I thought we had the 20th century. But then again, as I've been saying, the right wants to repeal the entire 20th century. So, right where we are. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Right back after this.
Rick Smith. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. In Michigan, public opinion is running against Republican Governor Snyder for his slash and burn budget and deep cuts to education. The Michigan Education Association says while Snyder succeeded in pushing the cuts through, his victory may be short-lived. Doug Cunningham reports.
The Michigan Senate has approved Republican Governor Rick Snyder's slashing of public education funding, more than $1 billion in cuts affecting all levels of Michigan public education. The cuts, though, are highly unpopular with the people of Michigan, according to polls. Michigan Education Association spokesman Doug Pratt says the Republican action is not the last word on public education funding in Michigan.
It's not really a done deal until the voters have a chance to react, and they're going to react. Polling shows that the public is incensed about this, and they're going to make their voices heard in November of 2012, if not sooner. The governor's approval rating has gone through the floor. The governor has said repeatedly that that's not something he's worried about. The lawmakers who have to run for re-election in November of 2012 are going to start to care very much.
Unemployment insurance programs are under attack. So far in the first half of 2011, 10 states have placed new restrictions or deep cuts on how unemployment is collected. The National Employment Law Project released a study this week finding six states had slashed the maximum number of weeks unemployment insurance can be claimed to less than 26. That number of weeks has been the standard in every state of the union for more than 50 years. Michigan, one of the states hardest hit by the employment crisis, cut the available weeks to 20. Missouri and South Carolina did the same. Florida has placed their unemployment benefits on a sliding scale. The higher the unemployment rate in the state, the more weeks available. If the unemployment rate in Florida slips down to 5%, only 12 weeks of unemployment can be claimed. Indiana has changed the way it calculates benefits. The average unemployment benefits will drop by $63 starting in July of 2012. Only two states, Colorado and Rhode Island, have addressed the unemployment insurance solvency issue by raising and indexing the taxable wage base. Many states instead chose to offer tax breaks to employers. The project is calling on the federal government to intervene. In their study, they proposed three possible relief solutions. One of the solutions is a proposal by Senator Dick Durbin and offers to waive federal interest payments on trust fund borrowing for 2 years, delay federal unemployment tax increases, and forgives up to 60% of state loans if states agree not to cut programs.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Also, if you want to email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Earlier in the program, I talked a little bit about the article that I had read that I just thought was so spot on that I thought, you know, in having conversations with folks, this is it. And it's called The 8 Reasons Young Americans Don't Fight Back, How the U.S. Crushed Youth Resistance. Written by Bruce Levine. He's also written a great book, Get Up, Stand Up, Uniting Populists, Energizing the Defeated, and Battling the Corporate Elite. Bruce, thanks for taking time for us.
Great to be back on your show, Rick.
You know, I'm looking through the article and I'm going, you know, I just had a conversation last night with a guy, 23 years old, saying, well, we don't need manufacturing in the U.S. We just need to plow ahead with the service-based economy. And I'm thinking, man, how did that happen? How did we brainwash someone to buying that line?
I know. It is sort of sad. I mean, how many people out there have kind of bought into that? They give these books to these folks, I think, in business school, these little Who Moved My Cheese kind of thing, which is sort of pathetic. Like, in other words, like, whatever changes that happen out there, you just kind of roll with them, you go with them. Like, I guess if, like, you make a whole economy where there's only people in prison and there's only prison guards, we're all supposed to be happy with that and fight to get prison guard jobs. I mean, it is getting increasingly pathetic with each generation how much our resistance has been broken to having a kind of a more democratic human society out there.
You know, when I was a kid, I was taught to question everything. You question authority. My mother taught me, if it doesn't feel right, you get away from it. And today we seem to be, and you pointed out in your article, teaching this walk-in-line compliance.
Right. We are, and I point out in many different areas of society, including my own profession, a psychology profession, increasingly authoritarian. I mean, and you saw that. I talk about a key year is like 1980. Not only Ronald Reagan gets elected, and we move towards a kind of more authoritarian political administration here, but we move even in my own profession, the psychology profession. We introduce a new diagnostic Bible, the DSM-3. This is the American Psychiatric Association publication, and they all of a sudden have diagnoses in it like oppositional defiant disorder, which you get a diagnosis of that just for often arguing with adults and often refusing to comply with adults. And at first when this comes out, a lot of us in the mental health profession, they say, you got to be kidding. We're laughing at this stuff. But increasingly people take this seriously, and they're drugging kids for this more and more. And so that's one of the eight reasons that I talk about in that article. My own mental health business is part of becoming increasingly authoritarian, and people just put up with it. I should, I guess, define what I mean by that word, authoritarian, very simply. Authoritarians are people who would demand unquestioning obedience to authority. Anti-authoritarians are people who question authority. They question whether an authority is a legitimate or not a legitimate authority. If they decide that the authority is not legitimate, they resist and they challenge that authority. And that's what's required in a democracy. You cannot have a democracy where you have authoritarian people walking around out there. And so as we, in many areas of our life, from our schools to mental health profession, on and on, become more authoritarian, it's impossible to have democracy.
Yeah, I agree. And it's the drug thing as well that gets me. And it's one of the things I worry about, because my son is a little hyper. He's going to, you know, he's got it in his eye, man. He wants to investigate everything. And one of my fears is that you're going to see them try and break that with drugs and break that with, you know, more compliance.
Right. Right, and that's one of the things that I talk about there, that if you take a look at some of America's greatest thinkers, greatest activists, they would all have been diagnosed with oppositional defiant disorder. I give an example in that article of Saul Alinsky, who's the great organizer out of Chicago there, who wrote Reveille for Radicals, Rules for Radicals, and for sure he would have been diagnosed with oppositional defiant disorder when he was a kid. And I give an example. Alinsky talks about when he was a kid, you know, he was sort of a oppositional. You know, he said, I never thought of walking on the grass until I saw a sign that said, keep off the grass, then I would stomp all over it. And he'd laugh about it, he outgrew it, and he realized, you know, there's certain things that make sense in life that you should oppose, illegitimate authorities, and there's other things out there that you don't oppose, and you outgrow it. And this ADHD stuff, this attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, very similar. A lot of these kids, the vast majority, they pay attention to what they're interested in. To,
exactly.
But they rebel against things that they're not interested in, just like Albert Einstein did when he was a little kid. He'd sit in his classroom and he wouldn't pay attention to school. It was boring for him. He's thinking about light, was it? You know, that's what he was thinking about when he was 7 or 8 years old, so he wouldn't pay attention. Well, for sure Einstein would be diagnosed with ADHD today as well and put on Ritalin and Adderall and all this speed. So you see some bizarre things in all aspects of our society. But again, that's just one area that I talk about in the piece.
Well, I mean, the ones that grab me, I mean, this normalization of surveillance you talk about. I'm about losing my mind. They're talking about putting cameras at every intersection because, oh, we want to cut down on traffic, or we want to watch speeders. And I'm going, whoa, 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 whoa. We don't need cameras everywhere. But
right, and this is one of the things that it's a lot of the left, a progressive, a need to kind of like catch up with a lot of libertarian anti-authoritarians, because I go on these shows and they're on top of that stuff, and they're right. I mean, I don't consider myself libertarian. I consider myself more, I grew up in a union family and a more like whatever you want to call left anti-authoritarian. But these guys are onto that. I mean, if you've got a society that every which way people are being controlled and surveilled, you're not going to have democracy. Now, where those libertarian anti-authoritarians are not hip to, and I have to kind of like talk to them about this, is like they're so obsessed with the government and the National Security Agency, which they're right about, but they forget that most of the surveillance that is going on in people's lives is on the job. I mean, it's cameras in warehouses who are watching these guys as they take 2 minutes extra in a, you know, go to a bathroom break or something like that. That's where it's going on the job, and your only protection is, and I talked to these guys, I said, well, what can you do about it? I said, these employers legally can do whatever the heck they want unless, you know what, you have a union. And that sort of stops them in their tracks, because a lot of these folks are anti-union, and it gets them to think, you know what, maybe these unions aren't such a bad idea. You know, if it stops, if that's the only way you can control being surveilled.
Yeah, I mean, most people don't realize when you cross over that threshold onto the employer's property, you have no more rights.
Exactly, unless you have a strong union. And they could keep that from happening, and they do keep that from happening. And as the union movement has gotten weaker, not only people are getting screwed in terms of their paycheck, in terms of benefits and all kinds of stuff, but that's a big area, you know, that if you go into, like I say, lots of jobs, especially warehouses, but even white collar jobs where people are looking, you know, their computers are being checked out, they're being monitored, whether they go online or on their Facebook and all this kind of stuff, is that you've got no protection over that at all unless you've got, you know, at the protection of solidarity in a union. That's the only thing that's going to can stop that.
Yeah, I agree. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Bruce Levine. He's the author of Get Up, Stand Up, Uniting Populists, Energizing the Defeated and Battling the Corporate Elite. And, you know, I love the title. I wish we could live the title, because as we're seeing these attacks going on across the country and coming here to Pennsylvania very soon, I'm encouraging people, get out in the streets, call your representatives, come to protests, camp out in the Capitol like they did in Wisconsin, but do something.
Right, and I think that's the important lesson that if you take a look at history, I mean, most kind of democratic movements, most democratic revolutions are started by a minority of people, including our own American Revolution here. It was not the majority of people who started this thing here. It was a small minority, and actually in the very beginning, they were only rebelling and resisting against the British Parliament taxation, again, you know, without representation. And even these future founding fathers, people like that are now famous, George Washington, I mean, they were afraid to actually rebel and resist against the whole British monarchy and everything there. And nobody was talking about independence as late as 1775 and even early 1776. And Thomas Paine comes over and he says, to heck with this stuff. He says, you know, we don't need these guys at all here. And he writes this thing called Common Sense. And within 6 months, you know, these guys are inspired. They're going, hey, maybe we could go for the whole thing. It's not just a rebellion against Parliament. It's a rebellion against the British East India Company, their monarchy, you know, everything about these guys. And so one of the things that, and you saw this more recently in Egypt, it took some people initially with guts, a minority population, getting out there and protesting. And then all of a sudden, just like cowardice and fear is contagious, so is courage. And you know, that's what happens in all kind of democratic movements, and that's why. That is exactly why. If you're at the top of the heap, you know, if you're in that top 1% who likes things the way it is, you like to have your billions and you don't give a damn that everybody else is, you know, going, you know, losing their homes and doesn't have a job and all that stuff, you want to make sure that people don't pick up that guts. You want to make sure that people are out of control and that they are afraid and to buck authority. And that's why you're quite happy with all those 8 reasons that I talk about in that piece of why people, you know, why young people are so subdued, how they've been in many ways demoralized, in some cases broken.
Yeah, and one of the things that you point out is television. You know, and I would put the whole media culture, all of that in there, that we've put kids into. We basically raise children with the TV as the babysitter, and people take pretty much what they see on television as fact to a degree.
Television is one of the big, big areas of how Americans are subdued. We watch more, as much or more than anybody in the world. And one of the things that progressives focus in on is just the content, which is problematic. I mean, you've got about 6 corporations that just about own almost all those channels that you see on TV. So, for example, General Electric owns NBC, CNBC, all of those NBC channels that you can see, they're all GE, and then there's a few others. Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation owns all those Fox channels, you know, and so that's problematic. But what's most problematic about television is not even the content. It's just what happens to your brain when you're zombified by watching that 5-6 hours a day, which is what Americans do. And young people, believe it or not, even with all the other technologies out there, that you would think they're watching less television because they're playing video games and movies and the internet, well, they've just added that stuff on. They're watching as much television as ever. And what it does is it keeps you from thinking critically. It socially isolates you. It teaches you fear, because most of what you see, a lot of the programming on television, you know, is about, you know, it is the kind of stuff that keeps you afraid of the world. So it's really, television in many ways is the dream come true for any kind of authoritarian society.
Well, it is the great controller, and which is why we don't let our kids watch any television. Which I've got friends who go, "What, you don't let your kids watch any TV?" I go, "There's nothing good on TV."
That's fantastic. Congratulations. And I mean, for me, TV is a drug, and what I always tell folks is that, you know, you got to view it as a drug, and you and that content better be unbelievably fantastic before you even think about it, because even when that content of that television is pretty decent, which almost never happens, but once in a while there's a decent show on there, that even then there's side effects to just watching it, and there's a kind of weird pacifying, subduing effect of it, even when there's good content on it. But of course, most of the content is garbage.
So as I'm reading through this, and I'm we've saddled our college students with enormous debt. We've done all these things over the years. Is there any hope? I mean, is this younger generation, are they going to, because I'm saying they have to be the next greatest generation. They're the ones who are going to have to clean up the mess that's going to happen.
Well, I got enormous amount almost of any piece I've ever done. Especially for Alternet, I got an enormous amount of comments on Alternet, but I also got a lot of private comments to me, and some young people were very upset, you know, telling me like, well, you know, how could you know what's going on for us, and we are doing some rebelling. And I said, great, I'm sure there are young people out there who are rebelling, you know, in any kind of society, even a slave society, even, you know, in the American slavery we had here, there were people who actually formed an underground railroad, and they were slave rebellions, but there was a small minority. And so there are young people who actually are resisting this kind of increasingly sort of authoritarian, totalitarian society. But most aren't, and less and less are. I mean, and you see it most obviously, not just in the anti-war movement, which there's very little, even though the vast majority of Americans oppose this war, and even though, you know, they think it's, you know, a lot crazy that we're spending all this money on military spending here when there's nobody really that we're afraid is going to, you know, that we're really afraid of here is going to take over this country. And so there's a lot of different areas that people clearly oppose and are hurting young people, that they're not doing anything about. And I think one of the things that I want to get across is that once you kind of understand that there's clear reasons that people all have become sort of subdued, and you talked about the student loan debt, that this is a clear thing that any kind of person out there who's walking around at 22, 23 years old with $25, $50, $100,000 worth of debt with their college degree and hitting the job market, it does something really horrific to your ability to buck authority. It does something really horrible to your ability to tell an idiot, abusive boss to go to hell and leave and find somewhere else. It makes you more likely that you're going to succumb. And so that's a huge area that young people have to kind of focus on. It's not like gravity that they should have this debt and that there should be this huge college tuition. In a lot of the rest of the world, including the Arab world, there is no tuition. A lot of Europe, there's almost very little tuition, and that's why you see people out on the streets, young people. They're not as afraid of doing these things. And so one of the things that young people have to understand is, you know, it sort of breaks my heart. With all this internet, you'd think people know a lot more, but it's amazing how many young people don't realize that American young people are getting screwed. They're being all shamed into going to college. They're being told they're losers if they don't go to college, but there's no public support for it as there is in the rest of the world. And so that's a big area that we can work on. And I go in the book, Get Up, Stand Up, I have a whole chapter devoted to kind of ending this kind of 21st century indentured servitude. What are the different things that we could do on a big political level, but also on a family personal level to kind of either reduce or eliminate our debt? Because that's a big, big area.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And not just for college kids, for everybody. I mean, one of the things that has been the last 30 years in the making is saddling people with massive amounts of credit card debt, second mortgages, home equity loans, all of that stuff. So as George Carlin says, they keep showing up to those crummy jobs.
Right, and that's, you know, one of the sad things that people do when they're kind of been beaten down by life and they know they don't really have any kind of real choice in democracy in a political sphere here. They know that there's barely any difference between the Democrats and the Republicans, just enough difference to kind of rope you into the next election, but in the major areas of wars and corporate control. So in a lot of giant areas in their life, they feel like there's no control. So where do they have some control? Well, it's in the area of consumption. And so they go, because there's so little kind of control or so little joy everywhere else in their life, it's like, well, okay, there's where I'm going to go into debt, and you guys told me my house is worth all this amount of money so I can kind of take a home equity loan and get something on that, you know, get something, have some kind of satisfaction in my life. That's the only area if I buy something. And then all of a sudden, not realizing, you know, okay, well, these guys can play a game there. All of a sudden, they can strip, you know, they can reduce your housing value. They can play these kind of Wall Street games, and all of a sudden, your $100,000 house is only worth $50,000 now. And so now you're completely screwed. And so now you feel even more powerless. And so increasingly, I think folks do get it. This is the good news. People do get it that these kind of, you know, rich bastards at the top of the society, they can pretty much do whatever the hell they want with you here unless you get back some of your guts, you get back some of your courage, and you start confronting what you can confront individually and also form, you know, some kind of a solidarity with other people and confront other things that you need help for. You need a group to confront.
Absolutely. Again, the book Get Up, Stand Up, Uniting Populists, Energizing the Defeated and Battling the Corporate Elite by Bruce Levine. Bruce, I appreciate the time. Always great talking to you. Look forward to having you back again real soon. And excellent piece. Excellent.
Good chatting with you, Rick.
Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Fellow working class heroes, I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Stealing is wrong, right? If you do the crime, the old slogan says, you do the time. But does everyone? Let's suppose that you robbed a Wells Fargo branch bank and scooted away with $5,000. Alas, you get caught. But you cut a deal with prosecutors. Naturally, you'd make restitution paying back the $5K, plus you agree to a $500 fine. In return, you don't have to go to jail or even admit guilt. Plus, you're allowed to issue a press release blaming the wrongdoing not on you, but on a relatively small group of rogue cells in your brain. What are the chances of a prosecutor or Wells Fargo letting you get away with such a punishment? Zero. But if it's Wells Fargo doing the crime, such coddling is the norm in our so-called justice system. Indeed, the financial giant was caught illegally tricking thousands of lower-income families into taking out predatory home loans with exploding interest rates that eventually would cost the families thousands of dollars each and their homes. The bankers merrily falsified mortgage documents, and the bank raked in billions of dollars. It was a widespread illegality fostered by Wells Fargo's top executives. So, on July 21st, prosecutors handed down justice to these miscreant bankers. Their punishment? An $85 million fine and a $20 million restitution payment, or 0.001% of this behemoth's annual revenues of $80 billion. Far from jail time, no Wells Fargo banker was even charged, nor did the giant have to admit guilt. A corporate press release blamed the unpleasantness on a relatively small group of low-level employees. This is Jim Hightower saying, do the bankers and prosecutors think we don't see this gross injustice? Banker thievery by Wells Fargo and its ilk will not stop until top bankers are made to do the time.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
This is the most unfortunate situation that I have seen in a long time in Washington as a result of one or two people who just really were not willing to compromise. They wanted their way.
And as a result of them wanting their way, 70,000 construction workers are idle in construction projects around America and airports, and 4,000 FAA employees are not receiving paychecks and haven't received paychecks for more than 10 days.
Well, that's Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood, a Republican, mind you. You know, I was surprised when Obama appointed a Republican as Secretary of Transportation, and there he is saying, look, it's a couple of people who are holding this country hostage, putting in, and I think his number of 70,000 is probably under, I've seen 90 to 200,000 as the number of construction people and other folks who are now unemployed because the Republicans decided that they were going to skip town without coming up with a reauthorization bill. And I lay this squarely at the feet of the Republicans, pure and simple.
About the mass media, I've heard them talk about now several times on about this FAA situation, and not once did they go into particulars. They just said, well, the Republicans left town, and they didn't take any action on. Not once did they get into the union issue. And what does that tell you about the mass media?
Well, they don't want you to know that.
They don't want you to know that. They don't want you to know that.
And talking about Ray LaHood, I'm looking at this cross-border trucking issue, and other stories come out saying, look, you know, here it's coming. You know, the Department of Transportation agreed to it. The borders are going to be open soon. You're going to start seeing Mexican trucks rolling across the lines. But you've got two representatives, DeFazio of Oregon, a Democrat, and Duncan Hunter, a Republican from California, who are saying, you know what, it's probably illegal to have this cross-border trucking program. Much like they killed back in 2008, if I remember right, 2007, 2008. So, you know, again, we're opening up the border. We're giving away jobs. And look, it's going to cost us thousands of jobs. And what I did today is for a moment, I went back and I looked at our trade deficit, surplus, whatever, our trade balance with Mexico. I came across some really interesting numbers. 1991, we had a $2.1 billion surplus. 1992, we had a $5.4 billion surplus. 1993, a $1.6 billion surplus. Then comes NAFTA. 1994, January 1st, 94, NAFTA goes into effect. We have a $1.3 billion surplus, down from 1.6. 1995. We have a $15.8 billion deficit. 96, 17, and it goes up from there. By the time you hit 2008, right before the collapse, 2008, we had, 2007, we had almost a $75 billion trade deficit with Mexico. 2008, because of the collapse, it dropped down to 64, went down a little bit to 47. It's working its way back up. 2010, back up to $66 billion. This year, on pace to take us back over $70 billion in deficits with Mexico. And again, you know, you look at these trade deals, and I keep saying, when can we have what we've given other countries? You stop and look at all of the deficit, all of the deficits we've had with just Mexico. You're talking hundreds of billions of dollars. Hundreds of billions. You look at the trade deficits we've had with China. Trillions of dollars. And I keep going, why do we keep going down this path? Why do we keep opening up ourselves to job losses and massive deficits? And the story on this cross-border trucking thing in USA Today lays it out. Corporations want it. Workers don't. Trade groups want it. Advocacy for the people, they don't. So, again, it comes down to this two sides. Which are you on? Are you on the side of the big corporations, the big special interest? Or are you on the side of virtually everybody else? And look, the big corporations are, oh, gee, you know, we're gonna be okay with this. It's gonna be fine. No, what it's gonna be is gonna be more of a race to the bottom. It's gonna be more of, especially in the trucking industry. You want to see pure capitalism at work? The trucking industry is pure capitalism at work. It is the the people who are doing the work, slitting each other's throats for pennies, and a the people at the top benefiting the most. You know, back before deregulation, you had rates that you had to pay. So it cost X amount of dollars to move a ton of freight or 1,000 pounds. It was a certain amount. And everybody played by that rule. So they competed on who had the best service, you know, who had the best quality. That's where the competition should be. Where the competition is now gone, in the, 30 years since deregulation, who's going to do it cheaper? Who's going to slit their neighbor's throats for pennies? And when you do that, you need to find cheaper and cheaper sources. So eventually, when the Mexican drivers say, we want, instead of 50 cents a day, we'd like a dollar a day, they're going to bring in people from Central America who will work for 50 cents a week. At the end of this, we're really opening this country up to some serious problems. And this cross-border trucking issue, I'm hoping that DeFazio and Hunter come around, and I hope they're right. I'm hoping they push this through, that we close off this border, because there's no business here. None whatsoever. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, Bob Ney, Talk Radio News Service. Back after this.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
When you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Thillman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make this thing happen!
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Just raise your head up and stand up. No fear in your heart. Tell me love and hope never dies. So raise your head up and stand up. No reason to cry.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C., our good friend Bob Ney. Talk Radio News Service. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick. How are you doing?
Great. I guess you're probably doing all right now that Washington's emptied out.
It's emptied out. Now, they're technically in session because they may pass a kind of, quote, clean FAA bill, possibly, which would just continue it for a while and then get to the issue of labor, which is what the Republicans are really after. They're after the prevailing wage.
And they're after the fact that they don't want the workers to have the same rights that other workers have with regard to elections.
You know, when Newt was there, there was 50 of us, literally stopped any attack on prevailing wage. There was 50 Republicans willing to sign letters and do what they could do. I don't know if that same atmosphere is there, but of course the Senate is still, check and balance on the prevailing wage.
Yeah, I look at that, and years ago, I remember there were Republicans who, you could rely on to stand up for labor. They had your ideological differences with the social issues, but people would seem to agree, if you work for a living, you should make a decent wage. That seems to be changing rapidly.
Ronald Reagan actually was, when the attempted assassination occurred, he was addressing the building trades at the Hilton. That's where he was. And the building trades actually, at the time, told me, one of the head of building trades said that the rumor was that somebody from their membership shot him, which they didn't, but they went into a panic. He was actually standing up for prevailing wage that day.
Yeah, I mean, it's It's something I hope the Republican Party comes back to. I'm hoping that we'll see that once again. But let's talk a little bit about this debt deal so we can finally put some dirt on this, because I'm looking down the road and I'm seeing big trouble. I mean, this big committee that supposedly is going to be put together, three Republicans, three Democrats. I'm not seeing good things coming out of this.
No, Rick, you're 100% right. You know, I from being a former member, I sat back and I looked at this and I thought, what a terrible way to craft a bill. I think I voted probably four times under Bush for the debt ceiling. It went without a whimper. Now, what do? They don't have an actual just vote on it. Then they have the super-duper committee. Boehner and McConnell get more of the appointments, the Republicans. It's a 7-5 split. There's a trigger in there with drastic cuts, 50% on domestic, 50% on defense, which, hey, the Tea Party people may actually lobby for that trigger, you know, to come in. That's a disastrous trigger. But they did a, Rick, in my opinion, they did a convoluted bill. This thing isn't done. And if we're worried about the bond rating houses, this is not a way to endear ourselves to them.
Well, as we've been seeing, the market still tanked today, right?
Right, it did tank.
And things still looks, bleak. We're not talking about job creation. We're talking about pulling money out of the economy. I think people are getting a little more antsy. And you look at the polls, nobody very happy with this.
And then, of course, China and Russia got together and dropped us from the AA rating to A. They dropped us down. Of course, they want the world currency in 2016. D.C. needs to start addressing the unfair trade balance if they want to do anything about jobs and also not cut good-paying jobs.
And that's something that I've been talking about for this entire debt crisis. Nobody was talking about our trade deficit. No one.
No one.
And I truly believe, I went back to 1975 and the last year we had a trade surplus as a nation, as a whole, and you just add up the numbers of how much imbalance we've had. We've had $10 trillion in budget in trade deficits with the rest of the world. Had we some balance, I don't know that we'd be having this debt talk right now.
And I can give you actual cases, not rumors or hearsay, but actual cases of things done when our products go to China. They literally torture us at the port, and we just let everything in as they please. There's just not a fair situation whatsoever.
So what is this? I mean, I guess it's an ideological thing. I think it's a blind faith thing, something. This whole free trade mantra that we've seemed to have bought full faith into, it's not working for us. It's working for everybody else. I wish we could have those deals in reverse, maybe get some of our wealth back. But I'm just not seeing them working, man.
No, it doesn't work for us. The first I called Unholy Alliance was Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich got together, and they said, well, we'll give permanent trade status to China. And that's what China wanted.
Yep.
They weren't going to change their behavior by giving them what they wanted. China only understands aggression. It only understands pushing back. And we just haven't done it. Nobody's talking about it. You're correct. You've been talking about it, which is a great thing, but the powers to be, just it's not on the radar screen.
And I just don't understand it. I really don't. I mean, you would think the business community would be going, hold on a second. This has gotten a little out of hand. We need to figure out how to pull back from this. And I understand the allure of going to China and saying, there are all these people and we've got all these potential customers, but the reality is most of them live on a couple of bucks a day.
Well, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce loves free trade. They were in our office constantly, angry at us. Well, we have to have free trade. But you look at the manufacturing base, and they kept losing all the jobs, but you've got the U.S. Chamber out there constantly as cheerleaders for a new trade agreement. Congressman Dreyer one time, trying to get my vote, which I wouldn't do, came up to me and he said, Boeing's having trouble. We need a free trade agreement. I said, well, maybe that's why Boeing's having trouble.
Absolutely.
So the thinking is absolutely skewed.
Yeah, we had a kid call here last night saying that we don't need any manufacturing. We could do just fine as a service-based economy. And he had no problem with Herman Cain and Newt Gingrich having their T-shirts made in El Salvador and Honduras. No problem at all.
And the other thing I think is really discriminatory, this society now, the government is saying, well, everybody needs to get a college education. There's a lot of people, and I'm from a coal mine area, so I'm biased, but a lot of good people simply can't pass college.
Yep. Well, want people who are able to build things. I want people who work with their hands. I'm going to need a plumber. I'm going to need people who tinker around. That's how we invented things. That's how this country became the innovator of the world.
That's right.
And I'm afraid we're losing that. I'm afraid we're seeing a brain drain happening right before our eyes as we allow the manufacturing base to leave our country.
Yeah, and China has chided us now, just in the last couple of days. I think their words were lame, and But they're just, again, for their own vested interest to take over the world's currency. So I hope as all the leaders exited, they all talked about jobs, all of them. But I would assume people will hear during the August recess about the debt ceiling. But I've got to assume with 2 million people unemployed in California, members of Congress are surely going to hear about the unemployment situation.
Well, I hope they'll put as much time into creating jobs as the Republican Party said they were going to do in the Grand Pledge, jobs, 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 and restoring trust in Congress. I hope they spend that much time actually creating jobs as much as they spend on the debt thing. Because the reality is, and you look at the new poll out, 77% of the people think everyone in D.C. were acting like children.
Yeah, it really, as I sat back and watched this thing and the history of the debt ceiling votes, I thought, how did it ever get to the point where it became so contentious? But, you know, you do have people, Jim Jordan of Ohio, and he's been criticized here, but, you know, Jordan campaigned as a Tea Party person, and so you knew what he was going to do when he got out there.
You know, I don't know that people really knew what they were going to do. I think people knew they were angry, and this was just a, hey, we're going to lash out, and this is, I think that's what people, I don't think they understood how toxic it was going to become.
It did, and it's not over with this, you know, this punting down the field with this super duper committee. They've got a December deadline.
So let me ask you the last question I got for you. You know, yeah, I was reading a piece by Bruce Bartlett, former policy advisor to Reagan and George H.W. Bush. He's saying we should just do away with the thing because from now until eternity, you're never going to get anything passed, and at some point in the future, it's going to blow up in our face.
Yes, because once this starts, no controversy all these years, every single time this thing's going to be raised, you're going to see the same thing happen. And the bottom line is it's going to be the members, you know, passing a budget that comes into some type of balance over a period of time. So the debt ceiling thing is just something that now has become a controversy. It will remain one.
Yeah, it's something we're going to have to deal with. Because to me, I think when you pass the bill and you appropriate the money, that's the time that you argue about it.
That's right. That's it.
Not down the road.
That's right. And then here they're kind of trying to do budgets within debt ceiling bills. Is exactly what they did.
Broken. That's the only word I can come
broken.
Up with.
I agree. It's somebody asked me my opinion. I said that we're kind of doomed. It's not a good situation.
And this is where we need statesmen, not children.
Yeah.
Bob Ney, I appreciate the time. Thanks for coming on and talking to us.
Already. Thank you.
Bob Ney, Talk Radio News Service. And now to find out what's going on across the street, what do you got for us this evening, Jake?
Yeah, thanks, Rick. The latest Quinnipiac poll, which is a very respected poll, came out with some political views of people in Pennsylvania. According to the poll, by 44% to 30% margin, they felt that President Obama acted more responsibly in the debt ceiling debate than did the congressional Republicans. Listen to these numbers on Congress, Rick. They disapproved by a 68% to 28% margin that the Republicans in Congress are not doing a good job. They also disapprove by just slightly less, 1 percentage point, by 67% to 28% that the Democrats in Congress are not doing a good job. Pennsylvania voters say 52% to 42% that Obama does not deserve to be reelected. When President Obama goes up against some of the Republicans, he goes up against Mitt Romney. He's actually behind him in these polls by a 44% to 42%. Against Rick Santorum, the president leads 45% to 43%. Going up against your girlfriend, Rick, Michelle Bachmann, the queen of the ditches, the president leads by about 47% to 39%. And against Texas Governor Rick Perry, who you had said you believe he's going to get into the race, and I think he will, the president leads by 45-39. We also talked a little bit last night, Rick, about this agreement that they reached yesterday. It passed by 74-26 in the Senate, and I think the problem that the Democrats and the president are going to have is that it has set up a committee. It has set up a committee. There'll be six on each side. It establishes a special bipartisan committee to draft legislation to find up to $1.5 trillion more in deficit cuts for a vote later this year. They're likely to come from such programs as federal retirement benefits, farm subsidies, Medicare and Medicaid. The savings would be matched by a further increase in the borrowing cap. Now, if this committee comes to deadlock, there'll be automatic caps that will kick in, and there'll be, according to a spokesman, a crippling round of automatic cuts across much of the budget, including the Pentagon. And, of course, that means going after Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare. Now, the problem I have is twofold. McConnell, first of all, has stated that him and John Boehner will look at the very best that the Republicans can throw on this committee. I think what he's talking about is they're only going to put people on there who they know will vote the way the Tea Party and the leadership wants them to vote. And another thing that bothers me about McConnell, literally hours after this bill was passed, Rick, he came out and said from now on, when we're talking about lifting the debt limit, there will be no clean bills. They will not support a bill which says simply lift the debt limit. They will expect more givebacks in the areas that the Democrats have been trying to protect against Social Security and Medicare. What I'm saying is I think now that the president let the genie out of the bottle, he's going to have this problem from now on. And I think that...
Well, not just him, but every president from now until the end of time.
And I don't think that's the proper way. We could take an hour to discuss that, but what they should have done, and that's why I'm critical of the president, he should have said, look, you guys aren't going to be reasonable. The heck with you. I'm just going to issue an order and say, pay the bills. After that, you want to sit down, we'll sit down and we'll discuss it in a rational way what we can do to get a hold of this crippling debt. He didn't do that. Now he's forced himself, even if he's reelected. Looks like the Republicans, especially if the Republicans maintain control one of the houses, I think this is going to mean long term some real, real problems for the Democrats. But we shall see. Something you talked about, Rick, the Jobs for Justice conference this weekend will be held in Washington. They will be joined by members of the Make Change at Walmart campaign. And Walmart employers, faith leaders, and community activists, they will be rallying in Friday, August 5th. And they will deliver a message to the world's largest retailer. Simply, pay what you say. According to Rich Trumka, instead of building good jobs, Walmart drives down standards and wages. When Walmart opens in the community, it regularly displaces existing jobs with poverty-level jobs. Tens of thousands of Walmart associates qualify for and utilize food stamps, Medicare, and Medicaid. This time of budgetary stress, Walmart's business model is subsidized on the backs of American taxpayers. Even with the company's health care plan, many workers whose average hourly wage is a paltry $8.81. Let me repeat that. The average wage at Walmart, for all the jobs that they brag about creating, the average wage is $8.81 an hour. Most of those who make that can't afford health care, and a significant number of Walmart workers rely on taxpayer-subsidized health care. In fact, in Massachusetts, for example, an astounding 42% of Walmart associates in 2009 relied on public health care. It's even worse than that. In three pretty good-sized states, Pennsylvania, Texas, and Tennessee, Walmart is the number one employer of having workers on subsidized health care, subsidized by the state. And what does that tell you? You and I are subsidizing the huge profits of the biggest employer in America, and that's absolutely disgraceful and unacceptable. Back to you, Rick.
All righty, let's take a quick break. We're right back to wrap things up. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
And the kids locked in the Capitol are fighting till the end. And we're not gonna break tonight, and we're not gonna bend. Some say the union's down, but I asked around, and everybody said, this is a union town, a union town. All down the line, this is a union town, a union town. All down the line, and if they come to strip our rights away,
a union town, all down the line.
Remembering the
But united we bargain, divided we bear.
You need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
With a PSECU home equity line of credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got our rates so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer is a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing life is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pseCU.com/life.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Yeah, you gotta love the Herman Cain train.
What I would do, you know what I would do? I find out how many employees does Fruit of the Loom employ right here in the United States of America. And so it's when people try to draw a comparison between some of the things that we buy, also look at how many people are employed. The same thing with cars, okay? Yep. A lot of the parts are made here in the United States.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And what about those salesmen and those salespeople that make a living selling products? So the fact that it was made in Honduras, I don't have a political statement with respect to that.
I think the fact that you had gotten shirts that were made in Honduras, I think that's statement enough, my friend. Statement enough. You got to wonder. I mean, these are the... I guess you got to give them credit. They're faithful to their ideology. They are buying products made out of this country. They don't care about jobs here, even though they keep throwing that out there. We're going to create jobs.